Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on July the 5th of 2017. What's going on, man? How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing very good, Nick. Happy post-Independence Day to you. The aliens didn't win, Nick. Once again, America reigns supreme.
Yep. Flew that F-15 inside of the mothership and blew it up, same as we do every year.
Damn straight. Uploaded a virus into their computer system that killed off their entire species and mothership.
Yeah, they thought that they had us when, you know, they put shields around our nuclear devices and... No, wait, that's the bad one. Well, when the president, like, flew back in after not being around for the entire battle and was like, no, I'll suicide this time. No, wait, that was the bad one, too. There was that portrait of Will Smith because we couldn't get him for it. Oh, wait, yeah.
Have you seen Independence Day 2, I'm guessing?
Yeah.
Do we want to, like, hold off the podcast and we'll just have, like, a group counseling session? Nick, just be honest. This is a place for you to be honest with your thoughts. How bad did it hurt? You're just like, I don't get what you do it if you didn't have Will Smith. I just don't get it.
It's really, really bad.
I think that.
You know, like, because I went to see it with some friends for a movie night. There was another movie we had thought about seeing, but I forget what it was now. Because, you know, this would have been, you know, obviously a year ago, basically. I mean, when the fuck did this... I don't even know if this movie actually came out around July 4th. I have to look this up now, because now I'm getting really pissed off because I'm remembering how bad this movie was.
I think it must have been in that general time frame, because it was a summer blockbuster. It would have come out during that.
Okay, good. It was released in June last year. So
yeah.
It would have... June. Good enough.
Yeah.
It would have been summer. It's really bad. They have this whole, like, next generation kind of thing going, because, you know, it's been 20 years since the last movie, so it's basically set up, so it's like, oh yeah, it's like 20 years since the last Alien Invasion, so here's, like, this new generation of kids, including, like, the grown-up version of Mae Whitman. We could have had Mae Whitman play this role, because, you know, she still acts, but, you know, she's not super hot now, so we're gonna get this new actress who sucks instead. I don't remember any of the characters, any of the new characters, except for badass African gorilla guy who killed aliens with a fucking machete. He was pretty awesome.
I think the one review I remember watching for that was the one thing they mentioned of, like, why isn't this dude, like, the movie? Why aren't they telling a movie about this dude who hunts, like, essentially, like, the predator but for aliens, like, exclusively a human, like, guy who's just a predator for aliens.
I mean, yeah, he's awesome, and, you know, I do remember seeing that, too. It was like, why aren't we just, like, seeing the stuff that happened in between the invasions, where it's just him trying to mop up the remains of the invading army with his group? Because there's this entire established, like, they are their own kind of, like, very isolated, independent army that are still handling things. And, God. That movie sucks. Anyway.
I guess we don't want to go down this rabbit hole too much longer.
No, I'm just going to get angry before we get even talk about anything.
Which is a shame, because this is, I think, a very good week of Jump.
Yeah. I don't have anything to, like, channel the anger into, Chris.
Honestly, of manga in general, I apologize. I shouldn't always just say Jump, because there are Crunchyroll series that we discuss in here, so it is a little bit dismissive to just say good week of Jump. So, a good week of manga. And I'm excited to talk about it. I've looked at the poll, because we have a poll on the Smashcast site where you can vote for your favorite series. That's where we kind of, like, put that in at the end when we talk about our MVPs. And there was a period of time where there was, like, a really huge favored winner, and I was like, well, this is going to be weird, because I vehemently think there's just one clear answer to Chapter of the Week, and it's not the one everyone was going with.
Shudan, you know.
Yeah. Chapter 4, Shudan, the kids.
Which we didn't get in the English Jump.
Was it a good chapter? I don't know. Have you heard things? Because Jeff's chomping at the bit for
more Shudan.
I'm sure
that Jeff loved it.
Jeff's like, it's weird. I think he listened to your podcast. This one ends with at least two of the kids killing each other. It's like, huh. Yeah, it's a blood sport manga now. I don't get why, but...
You know, it starts off with what's his name and Akira, you know, like getting along, getting to know each other, and then she just reaches into his chest and pulls out his heart while she smiles the whole time.
Holy shit! I am 10,000% more interested in Shudan now with that notion. It's just like the secret, like, kids Mortal Kombat manga.
And he, like, the last thing that he sees is his own still beating heart in her hands while it goes, Shudan, Shudan. Shoot,
and then the last panel is just an image of the mangaka staring at the screen. He's just like, "Are you happy now, you dickhead podcast?"
And he's pointing at you, somehow just at you.
Yeah, I'm just like, does anyone else feel like he's pointing directly at you? Like, no, I don't see that. I'm like, oh.
Why is his finger vibrating as it points at me?
Yeah, his finger, like, follows me around the room. Sometimes, like, my web browser just opens up right to that page, which is weird, because it's a Flash program, so it doesn't have that ability to, like, memory hold where I was in at the magazine at that point.
I'll shut down my computer, and it'll still be on my monitor.
Think anything's weird with that? Eh, whatever.
It's fine.
You know what? I'm not going to worry about it.
Guys, he started crawling out of the monitor. I'm really concerned now. It's okay. It's okay. I've heard the new Rings movie sucked too. So
everything new sucks, Nick. You gotta do new stuff like Glow. You know, where you get a bunch of lady wrestlers around and the comedian who I to this day I'm like, if I don't know if they bothered casting for this because I can't imagine anyone else doing your role in this. Mark Maron's like such a specifically neurotic person that. I'm like, did they write lines for him, or they were just like, Mark, be neurotic here for 5.5 or so minutes, and he just does it.
I have heard really good things about that show. I haven't had time to watch it yet.
It's really neat, too, though. It's very solid. There's a surprising amount of Allison Brie, is that her name? Or no?
Yeah.
Yeah, Allison Brie. Surprising amount of Allison Brie topless in it. Which to say, there was any. I didn't expect any nudity in that series.
You wouldn't really expect that, no.
But, yeah. It's a solid show, though. I'm about, I think, 7 episodes in.
Do you think that, like, maybe someone was like, would you ever do a topless scene? And she's like, only if it has to do with cheesy 80s wrestling.
Yeah, only if it's in the same series that also includes Brodus Clay and John Morrison. That's the
Brodus
only
Clay's
condition.
In this series?
Yeah, there's no WWE character, like, actors or anything like that. And right. I guess everybody like, gave the permission to like use some names and things like that, but outside of that, there's no involvement with it. But you will see a lot of WWE cast-offs who are in it. I think John Morrison and Brodus Clay are the ones I kind of immediately have picked out, but
John
I'm sure there are others.
Goes up in a lot of stuff, but Brodus Clay is surprising to me.
Yeah.
Hell, he was probably just like, do I have to be Brodus Clay? No. Okay.
Well, they don't play themselves, I should note. They're all playing fictional characters.
All right.
I guess we should talk about manga eventually.
We probably should talk about manga. It's, we don't have as many series to talk about this week because Shudan finished up its jumpstart, so we don't have that. And, also Black Clover is off this week. So, we've only got like 10 chapters to talk about this time as opposed to like 13. I think we do some weeks. But I guess let's just dive into it. It's the recap portion, weekly manga recap. In a couple of weeks' time, probably we'll have Rave Master ready to go as we prepare for the end of Fairy Tail, which we'll be talking about pretty shortly. I think that there's like three or four chapters left after this one. I think four.
Really?
Yeah.
Things are going to start wrapping up pretty quick. All right.
Yep. Okay, so, actually, let me see here. All right, the Japanese version of the latest chapter says 4 chapters until the finale, so, you know how countdowns, like, with only X episodes left are? It's always kind of weird how they count those. You never know exactly, like, are you counting this one? Are you counting the last? I remember being really, really upset as a kid. This is such a weird tangent. It's not that we're going out of time, it's just this really weird number that I have.
Go for it. Explore.
Do you remember in Power Rangers Zeo, there was a really big mystery over who the Gold Ranger was?
Very, very vaguely. I tuned out of Power Rangers during Zeo, so I don't have as many memories of it.
So there were certain, there was like a couple of side characters that they suggested it could be. There were hints that maybe it could have been Billy returning to become a Power Ranger.
I wish.
But no, it turns out they were too busy harassing him for being gay. Then at the end it turned out to be some alien who we had never met before. So it was like, oh, how the fuck could you have possibly known this? But there were promos that they would run in the lead up to the reveal of who the Gold Ranger's identity was. They would say, like, you know, in 5 days, they will review who the power, how they would do it every day like that. In 4 days, in 3 days. And then it came down to in 1 day, and I watched the next episode and they didn't do it. And I was like, what the fuck? And then it showed a promo tomorrow. I was like, wait a minute. You do 1 day and then tomorrow? Fuck you.
I was like, that's just wrong.
That's incorrect. In 0 days.
I like to think Kid Nick, who also has, like, the goatee and glasses, it's just you in, like, a child's body, essentially, was just like, it's bullshit! It's bullshit! Mom! Power Rangers is bullshit!
Still have my really deep voice.
You came out of the womb like, wah! Wah! Mom, this is bullshit! Wah! Hurt! Wah!
Wah! Bleach sucks! Wah!
I don't know. He's been talking about bleach for a really long time. I don't know what it... I thought he meant the cleaning liquid, but he doesn't. He just keeps talking about ghosts with swords or something. Something to Zapato or Zombado?
Zapatas. It's the Spanish word for shoe.
He keeps screaming about a brain in a jar. I'm very concerned.
All right, before we go... As wonderful a visual as that is, I feel like we've strayed far off the beaten path. Let's talk about My Hero Academy, actually. Number 143, Let's Rumble Rappa. That sounds like a video game title. Anyway, last time, Rappa and some dude, Tengai, that's his name, two villains confronted Fat Gum and Kirishima. And, basically, they made this whole big deal that, oh, well, Tengai and Rappa are respectively a shield and a spear, whereas Fat Gum and Kirishima are just both shields. So how could they possibly help to go against them? We see at the beginning of this chapter that Rappa and Tengai don't always get along incredibly well, because Tengai's got a very calm and objective analytical point of view, and Rappa just likes to really punch stuff a lot. The Rappa then turns on him and starts trying to punch him, and he can't get through the barrier, so there you go.
I like to think these two would be us if we were a part of the villain group. Like, you would be the very calm one who's like, Chris, no, we have a strategy, let's stick to it. And it's me just being like, I should go in now, Nick! I should go in now! You're like, no, there's the team's not with us, don't go in now. And then I do it anyway, and we all learn something from it.
But our attitudes don't match our powers at all. Like, your power is, like, stealth, and mine is blowing shit up.
Guys, I'm being really quiet! Nobody's gonna know where the fuck I am! This reminds me of that one scene in Lost where...
It's a spy! Anyway. So, Fat Gum gets the shit knocked out of him a whole lot. Fat Gum get punched and punched and punched and punched. And he's analyzing that despite the fact that he's got his absorption ability, he's still suffering a lot of damage from each blow. It's really not working out for him as well as he would like it to. And also, he can't go on the offensive because he hasn't got enough strength to even remotely get through the shield that this guy summoned. So... he's like, okay, I've got an idea. If I screw this up and I'm dead, oh shit. So he provokes Rappa into just going into a one-on-one rumble with him. He's like, all right, let's go see which of us is stronger, the spear shield. Let's rumble. And, so Rappa's like, hell yeah, let's do this shit. Tengai, don't put up a barrier. This is going to be awesome. And, he just lays into him over and over and over again. Which, obviously gets Kirishima really upset because Fat Gum is obviously doing this in order to protect him. And so Kirishima is back into his, I'm worthless and I have to be protected like this. Even with my ultimate move that I was so proud of, I got smashed up like I was nothing. I'm just in the way here. So he keeps watching as Fat Gum is getting his, like, his coat is, like, getting torn off of him by the pressure of the blows that he's suffering. And Kirishima is continuing to despair while this is happening because he thinks, oh man, Fat Gum's gonna die from this. So, Fat Gum reveals in an inner monologue that this is his plan, is to suffer all this punishment so that he can use his absorption ability. After every one of the blows are getting absorbed, it's sinking into me, and canceling out the hits takes a mountain of energy. It burns off all the fat that's serving as my shield, so my defense is getting eaten away, but every blow gets stored. I'm forging a spear that'll crack any shield out there. Essentially, he's, there are so many, like, video game, like, equivalents that you could do from all of this.
Bide.
Like, yeah. Bide's probably the easiest go-to one. You know, the more damage I suffer, the more it's gonna fuck you up. So, okay, I can take it. Rappa kind of gets more and more intense, and even when Tengai is warning him, hey, you know, he's up to something, so you should finish him off, and Rappa's like, oh, whatever, just keeps on punching him. He's like, show me what you've got. This is, you know, survive all of this. And he goes in for what appears like it's going to be the finishing blow, but Kirishima gets in the way with his maximum hardness activated again. He gets the crap beaten out of him, but he refuses to step down, plant his feet, and digs in. And he's just like, I'm just going to harden right back up every time I break. And, that's not this big challenge.
Then harden to use, like, for Kirishima's
movements. Yeah, I know. He's young. He can manage to do that. So this battle cry and goes to counterattack Rappa, but the shield comes back up in between him and, from Tengai. And, Tengai's like, oh, whatever. No technique can overcome my defense. He can only submit. And as he says this, Kirishima collapses from overexertion. But Fat Gum says, well, it was a wasted effort. So now it's you protecting me, little guy? Well, it feels kind of insulting, but now this big old spear is ready for action. And all of the power that he's absorbed, the force of the blows, has been channeled into his fist, and all of his fat is burned away. So, cool.
You know... So I made that suggestion last week. I was like, oh, this might be cool because I think what we'll get is, like, we'll find out something else Kirishima has where he turns out to be the spear and all this. Like, he'll have some extra technique. And obviously, that's not what happened. It's the inverse. Fat Gum's the one who actually has a hidden kind of talent beyond there. But Kirishima still got his moment to, like, kind of get him to that point. You know, he gave everything he had to give his mentor that extra time. And that's awesome. I love that, like, this is the way his power kind of went, that... You know, underneath this big fat persona is what I assume Annalise would probably say something like, oh, he's such a cutie, or what a cute boy, or a good boy. Whatever terminology Annalise uses for these sorts of things, I know they're out there.
He can be my cousin who's the same age.
Exactly. I like that there is, like, a different design there. I think it's somewhat interesting that Fat Gum's the one who gets this moment, because it all makes sense. It's cool. And Fat Gum has been, earnestly, one of the best characters to come out of this entire, like, past year or so of Jump. My hero, of all these new mentors and stuff coming about. You know, Sir Nighteye maybe didn't hit the spot quite as much. We haven't seen much from Lady Dragon. But Fat Gum, we've gotten quite a few different times to see what his personality's like and to see him as a mentor. So it's one of those things where it's like, oh, getting to see this is kind of cool. Like, oh, you get this and you get to, you know, see some more depth to this character. But it's also one of those things where it's like, hey, you know, you got a pretty big group in Class A already. And we're going to give some, like, of the biggest character, like, cool moments to, like, outside instructors and things like that. It's a little bit strange there, but I couldn't even possibly, like, really put my mind to it because I thought this was the coolest fucking shit that I had seen in a while. I, like, as soon as I read this chapter, I was like, there's not even a, This is the chapter of the week, and it's the MVP of the week. I'm telling you right now, nothing else comes close to this. This shit was bananas awesome, which is not a term, but I'm making it one.
It's just a really cool final visual that you get where, you know, the fat's burned away and there's this reveal of what he looks like without it. And his costume's so torn up that's revealing, you know, this, like, freaking washboard chest underneath all the fat. And his hair is flowing out from around his mask. He's still got the kind of weird, goofy-looking teeth, so you can so easily tell it's still him. But he looks like a badass. You're rearing back to launch his punch. So, yeah. Really cool moment. I really feel like it should just, like, not even show him launching the punch at this point. It's like, there's no way you can top that moment of him rearing back like that. Just cut to some other thing and then show back later. Yeah, of course he won after that.
The only way it could live up to it is if it just does the Chad Diablo punch thing where he punches them and just a giant skull-shaped impact appears on the wall behind them.
And then Noitora shows up and hits him.
You know, it wouldn't be. I really love this, and I think part of the reason I like this, because I was doing, while we were kind of discussing this, I was putting together a few things on our year-end superlative awards, and this has been the first entry that I've had thus far as a candidate for the best fight of the year. I kind of recognized that, like, oh, there haven't been that many, like, great fights this year in Jump. I mean, it doesn't help that, like, several of the series we talk about are ones that aren't, like, battle manga. Like, Dr. Stone and Promised Neverland are never going to have contenders, really, for that, it seems. So, I guess maybe Dr. Stone, if you want to, like, be like Tsukasa versus Simple.
There was a fight scene just last week in Dr. Yeah. Stone. It was brief, but yeah.
Yeah, but still, like, of all the other, like, you know, battle series we've had, none of them have had, like, a crazy fight yet or anything like that. So, this was kind of the first of the year that maybe be like, ah, fuck yeah, that was dope as shit. And, I'm pretty happy about that. I think maybe that's why I liked it so much. But this is just to hit on everything I kind of like about, you know, Jump Shonen battle manga series. So, I loved it. Yep. All right, okay. So we're going to move on then to Fairy Tail, Chapter 542, Instinct. And I guess we're getting close there because they've, I think, reached just about the end of arcs to give the cover to, because this one's just a shot of, I guess, Fairy Tail Zero.
Yeah.
Which, I guess, I don't know why. Does it feel like they're really forcing Mavis's feet out a little too much?
She's barefoot, Chris. You have to know she's barefoot.
You know,
also,
she
doesn't seem to be wearing anything underneath that dress.
I mean, I don't think you could tell from there, but it's mostly just like, I didn't realize it at first until I, like, saw it, like, in peripheral vision while flipping through the page. I was like, why are her feet so prominent? Oh, okay, because they're drawn that way. Fair enough. Anyways, so, the Dragon Slayers, stuck inside of Soul Acnologia, fighting him there. Physical Acnologia, wrecking shit up.
No, hold on, Chris, hold on. You're going a little fast for me here.
Right, hold on. Let me open up my PowerPoint.
Soul, physical, barrier, Acnologia. Now I'm going to also translate this into a bar graph.
I'm like, oh, wow. You have, like, a point graph that, like, goes up and down based on your knowledge of the situation. You're like, it started off okay, then it went really high, then a second graph lost me. I have no idea what's going on anymore. That's why I'm down here now. Then I'm starting to go up a little bit, then I just coast for a while. I stopped caring for
this. I'm just going to stop paying attention.
Here's where you can see I started watching Glow, so my knowledge goes down and down as more stuff's getting lost.
Just started listening to Kalista's theme.
Yeah. It's just you with, like, images of these pie charts in front of you just going, Lucha! 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 wrestling jokes no one will get. So, there's still two fights going on.
We need to go more obscure for that, I think.
That is true. And the big thing right now it starts off with is they're trying to get this plan together of get Acnologia over to this harbor town where there are boats, get them on the boat, and then find out what spell is needed to cast Fairy Shell or Fairy Orb. I forget what the name of Fairy Shield, maybe. Orb Shieldy Protection spell. They need to find a way to get that so that they can enact their plan to put Acnologia on a boat, trap him in it, and he'll get sick, and that's how they'll beat him, essentially. So this chapter's primarily about how Acnologia is functioning, particularly that physical form of him, because Acnologia's brain, his soul, that's in this metaphysical realm that's fighting the Dragon Slayers. What's left is just a physical body. And as Minerva notes, it's not thinking, it's just acting on instinct. It seeks out a place with high magical concentration and is, like, just eviscerating it because it knows that that's where the threats are. So that's how Actology is functioning.
It's kind of a weird thing to need to be explained at this point in the game, honestly. It's like, you know, we've known Acnologia for a while now. We kind of got to know how he, you know, thinks, which is, you know, he thinks of himself as this godly being, phenomenally arrogant and ruthless and sadistic. And now it's just like, well, he's an instinctive creature. It's like, well, what does that mean? It means he blows up boats and follows magic.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that maybe didn't have to be explained, but I think it functions for what they're trying to do here. They're trying to explain how the body is acting without the mind operating on it, and I guess just kind of showing the kind of mentality imprinted within Acnologia's very genes of just always thinking about how to reach his goal. I kind of like this because I've kind of always noted, like, Apocalypse Dragon has been my favorite villain in Fairy Tail because he's the only one who just doesn't seem to give a fuck about friendship and seems to be immune to it. So I kind of like this notion that this really just does kind of build to this idea. He is just this cruel, savage motherfucker who just is actively always trying to succeed. Like, he is actively trying to finish off the world. Like, even this moment where his brain's not in his body, he's like, the body just knows to start fucking up your plans.
Yeah, he didn't. I mean, that is something that can be said about him, is that he never really spent any time, like, fucking around or having something. The only time that he really wasn't doing anything was because he got transported to another continent. So yeah. It's like, well, I have to get back.
Yeah, there were people actively trying to keep him from doing things at that point. There's a quick cut inside of the Soul World where Actologia is just crushing the Dragon Slayers. He just makes a note of, like, you know, magic doesn't work on me. Which, to this point, it's like, why do you keep trying? You know he's immune to magic. Well, I guess they weren't technically present for that explanation, so maybe they don't. I don't know. I feel like someone should have said it at some point, but c'est la vie. Cut away. Harbor City. They found a boat, and they're like, shit, how are we going to get him onto this boat? And Urza's basically made up her mind that she'll be the one to do it. She's gonna have to just give everything she can, and she'll force Acnologia onto this boat. Cut to the fairy token.
I'll do it with my friendship.
Yeah, and my armor that covers actually very, very little of me.
It's just like, you know, a couple of pasties and then, like, just kind of like tape and hope on the crotch.
You know, there are times where you could note, like, Urza's armor's just fan service, whatever. But then there's times where the series actively showed it to be a weakness, like that time she was fighting the Oratian Six, and she transformed into, like, her fucking tribal bikini armor shit, and then immediately got bit in the leg, like, on the thigh with a stake that poisoned her. And it's like, you know, if you had armor on your leg instead of a loincloth or whatever this is, you wouldn't have been able to do it.
Oh, shut up and let me switch into my poison cure armor. It's just like leather bondage gear.
Some other new kink that Hera's letting out. It's like some Lolita gothic costume with, like, roller skates on it.
I'm really into nuns this week, so that's... just wears a headdress and a cross and that's it.
Cut aside to Fairy Tale. Lucy's found the book. That didn't take a lot. She got it.
Yeah, I mean, all that it needed was for, you know, like, you know, fuck all this, like, you know, searching around stuff. She just needed the bookshelf to fall on her, and then it just, like, falls on top of her, and she emerges from the pile within her hand. I got it!
Yeah, Acnologia's, one of his blasts hit Fairy Tale, the guild, but according to Makarov, it's like, don't worry, it only hit one of the, like, base supports for it, so the rest of us are okay. And it's like, it seems dangerous, but whatever. Yeah, and I guess the ensuing shuffle knocked free the book from behind. It doesn't seem to suggest it. She just found it. That plot point, done, I guess.
Good.
Cut back inside, and Cobra actually gets a scene to kind of show his mentality. He gets kicked by Acnologia. He notes how it's so devastating with only a single attack, but that he won't give up because he has his friends. He's going to do whatever it takes to protect them. And they actually cut aside to show the efforts his friends are trying to do to stop Acnologia's physical form, how they're basically riding off using
their... I had to just kind of assume that they were Cobra's friends because I was like, who are these people?
These were characters from a really long time ago.
I know, because Cooper was a villain a really long time ago.
Again, it's still that weird thing of just, like, it seems like you should have done more with him if you made him a Dragon Slayer. And again, he's that fake Dragon Slayer, which I still don't really get, but...
Now, one of them is Serrano, and I do remember them being associated, very vaguely. So that's not the part that confuses me, is the fact that she gets a little bit of focus. It's the fact that she's riding on Sawyer's back for some reason?
Yeah, well, he's like a speedster. Like, his magic is speed.
Oh.
So it's basically, like, using that, like, super speed to get her places.
And why is she still wearing a bikini, then?
I don't know, Nick, because it's fairy tale. Why would women wear anything more than bikinis is the question you probably should be asking.
Why would they wear any more than the...
why are they even bothering to wear bikinis? The censorship
board will allow me to get away with.
And basically, the sentiment is shared amongst all the other Dragon Slayers. They're all talking about how they have friends out there fighting, so even if things are hopeless, they're not going to give up. This is your final fight, Actalogia, Natsu says.
No, I think it would be kind of funny, because we see Sting and the other one.
Sting and...
Rogue, right?
Not Sting, yeah, Rogue, yeah, Sting and Rogue.
Right. We see them do the same thing, and then we see the members of Sabretooth, of course. So I thought it'd be kind of funny if they cut to Wendy, because what if afterwards it shows like the village that she was raised in is just empty?
It's just a bunch of gravestones. Oh man!
Tumbleweed rolls by.
Oh, Grey Bob is bringing up something in the chat. Racer's power wasn't super speed. They revealed that it was him slowing down the people around him, which. Then that really wouldn't make any sense.
That wouldn't help him at all.
You know what?
Maybe he's faking it because it looks fast to Serrano. So that, oh yeah, it'll be totally fast for you. Oops, against my back.
All right, yeah, this is sweet. You know they're gonna be killed, right? Eh, whatever.
go out and enjoy life.
What I love though is Actalogia's response to that, where he just says, "Final." Bitch, this shit hasn't even begun yet. You kidding me? Final? Like, I just want him to get, like, the cigar in his mouth, like it's Cape Fear. Like, everyone's like, sir, this is way too much.
No, hold on, I'm not done yet.
But it's time, because Actalogia has shown up. They have the boat. They have the spell. Actalogia is here. They just need to get together. Everybody get in the circle, hold hands. Urza's going to bring him down. And then Actalogia stops, and you just start seeing flashes in the air, and he lets loose this barrage of blasts, and we get this pretty cool 2-page spread of him just destroying the harbor of this town, just absolutely obliterating it, and everyone's like, holy shit, and that's when Minerva notes, he instinctively knew that the boats could be a weapon used against him and immediately destroyed them. So it
Which
seems...
Which is why he, you know, destroyed the ship and shot it out of the air when he was chasing after it.
So it seems like Actalogia has put a damper on the plan, and if there are truly
it's
only...
Not, it's like the least necessary component of the plan, though.
True, but there's only about 4 chapters left, you said, so I guess they're going to have to figure out something pretty quick.
The entire point of the ship was so that he would be nauseous for approximately 10 seconds so that they could catch him in the bubble. They could still catch him in the bubble.
But they need him to be weakened, or else he'll just, I guess, jump right through, or I don't know. They still need, I guess...
Trapping him in close proximity to the ship, or...
Well, I think they just needed to get him on a vehicle. They need to get that travel sickness thing out of him.
But I thought that was entirely so that he would be, like, distracted.
I know. I think it's the inverse. I think the bubble's meant to keep... The bubble is the distraction. The bubble's to keep him on the ship so that they could fight him while he's...
I'm going to go back while we're discussing this and look at the previous chapter where they actually established Lucy's plan.
Yeah, I think in general, though, this is a fine chapter. Like, I like building up Actalogia and making him seem just crazy intense, you know, super strong, just ruthless in his way of doing everything. I think it really builds him up to be, like, a truly intimidating figure. I'm excited for the notion of what this guy basically becomes at the end of this. Like, it feels like this actually is fitting the idea of a climactic final battle. We haven't yet reached that point where I feel like we might, where it somehow just ends up with Natsu versus Aquilogy and everyone else is irrelevant. Maybe we will, maybe we won't get that point. Because what I really like about this in comparison to some of the other series that have ended in recent memory is this one actually does feel like everyone in the universe is trying to stop this big bad.
Okay, so here's their discussion of the plan. I need a bunch of you to head to Harajin Harbor. Find the biggest boat you can and get it ready to sail. The Dragon Slayer's weakness. You want to get Aquilogy on the boat? And Serrano says, all that's going to do is make him all pukey for maybe a few seconds. And Lucy says, that's all we need. While he's distracted, we can use the one magic that blah, 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 blah. One of the three great magics of Fairy Tail, Fairy Sphere. So, the boat's the distraction.
I think, I don't want to get into like a bubble road argument on this. I think the notion is just that I don't know what the shield would do independent of it, unless this is their idea of creating a prison.
So it would be a prison for him.
But I assume it goes away after a while.
No, friendship lasts forever.
Chris, yeah. Chris, come on. Friendship never dies, stupid.
If you hurt my friends, then you hurt my pride.
I gotta be a man. I can't let it slide. N-word, N-word, N-word. They're like, hey, Nick, have you ever noticed this many hidden N-words in Hulk Hogan's opening theme song? I'm starting to realize this shouldn't have come up as big a shock to me.
In general, yeah, I'm with you where how this chapter plays out, the attitudes that are on display, you know, it's just very straightforward, you know, you're the bad guy, we're the good guys, you're evil and maniacal, and we'll pull through with this, but then you throw in the last monkey wrench at the end where their plan isn't going quite as smoothly as they had hoped it to, so that there's still tension, that's good. This entire dragon motion sickness thing, still stupid.
It is. It's incredibly stupid. It'll never not
be. 540 chapters into the series, and it's going to be used to defeat the final villain. It has never made sense.
It really is of that notion that, like, I'm trying to think of like an equatable thing in One Piece. Like, if they defeated Blackbeard after he was like ill, this devil fruit tastes really, really gross, or something like that. Like, you're like, this comedic element of things, it doesn't seem to have much of a basis of explanation or something like that, is like the final catalyst to everything. If like Khan's soul pill was what defeated Uobach in Bleach, you're just like, really?
I actually have a friend who thought of using that to defeat a villain in a story he was writing, but anyway. Oh, God. Most part, I did like this chapter, but still, this is like, oh, he knew to destroy the ships. Fucking boats, man. Oh, no, our boats.
It's weird that, like, everyone's like, what do we do now? It's like, wait, like, the untold magic powers within you guys, the ability to, like, alter reality. Some of you have the ability to literally warp space and time, and none of you are just like, oh, yeah, I can make a boat. Like, can't Gray...
That's a boat magic, Chris!
Can't Gray make a boat out of ice, and then should that suffice? They're like, well, no, because it wouldn't function like a boat. It would be too heavy. It wouldn't be buoyant or something like that. I'm like, what fucking arbitrary rules exist for this stupid...
Gray, makes a ship out of ice, and people are like, no, there's really bad framework here.
It's just like, what the specific framework is this Dragon Slayer, say, like, travel sickness thing
this
under?
This rubber won't work. Like, there's too much friction between the ice.
We're gonna have to redo the bow. I know you put, like, the mermaid on here. I'm actually a little offended by that. We need to start
also,
over.
Also, how would ice sails possibly work?
He's like, it doesn't
it
need...
blow.
He's like, it doesn't need to go anywhere! Just needs to trap him. I don't like this idea. Doesn't seem feasible.
2 stars.
In the last moments.
My magic is just reviewing you on Yelp.
Just his last act in the world is to give someone a shitty Yelp review. Sincerely yours, Frosh.
Look, it'll work just fine. Frosh doesn't think so.
Like, arrogant, douchey Frosh. Like, it's just Frosh with a goatee. He's just like, Frosh doesn't believe so. It's just like, you're right there, Frosh. That's not going to work.
Hashtag grain, Frosh.
Oh, those two need a spin-off series now.
All right, let's move on to Shokugeki no Soma. Food Wars, Chapter 221, The Great Spice Battle. Sounds like a kid's movie, doesn't it?
The Great Spice Battle?
Yeah.
Maybe like when the Spice Girls were around, I could see it.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's more focused on Megashima and Rindo's battle, using red chili peppers.
Red hot chili peppers, Nick?
No. Oh. So... Damn it. Megashima announces that he's going to be making African ramen. And everyone's like, what's that mean? Everyone's like, Africa, like elephants! Oh, elephant versus alligator! What kind of battle is going on?
When, that super, super, kosher jump racism kind of peaks in a little bit there. It's like the one black guy with a close-up on his cartoonishly oversized lips is just like, yes, red peppers, Africa, I see. It's like, oh, come on, man.
At least this isn't like some sort of like tribal warrior fighting the alligator instead.
It's just like the super, like, like the old stereotype character from the Looney Tunes.
So, the judges, yeah, go on a little bit of kind of shared monologue thing. And I actually might remember their names now, because it's like, okay, the black guy is Histoire, the other male judge is Charm.
I'm going to call him Charmy.
Charm. And the girl is Une. And Une is super drunk. And
why is she drunk?
Because, as Charm explains, well, she had some of that sake a little bit ago. The kind that they sampled that Ryoko had made that got used in Ishiki's dish.
Ah,
yeah, she sampled some of the sake. Gotcha. Literally, like, that much. And apparently that made her super drunk. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't know if I need to see these judges come back again afterwards. They've been slowly dropping off ever since that chapter where it's like, hey, they're all good friends. Every chapter afterwards has been a way of me being like, yeah, you know what, I'm not a big fan of these guys.
I don't know if I like them being obsessed with the size of her boobs.
Or them all joking about like, yeah, she gets drunk pretty easily, but that makes her also a much better cook. Why? Because it does.
And somebody says, is that how that works?
Like, it's weird for a series that tries to use, like, the legitimate sort of food science at points. Just, like, it's like, no, she tastes better because she's, like, when she's drunk. She just is more of a cute palate. Why? It's funny. It's like, I don't know if it is, but all right.
We get just kind of some stuff that Megashima's doing just to prepare his dish. You're like, all right, chicken, we're going to stock pot. Oh, no, Chris, will he use chicken stock with chicken?
I wish it, every time it
never
happened.
Never gonna make you drop that.
I wish every time it happened, they called just as much attention to it.
Like, it's like, just like, without explanation in the middle of this explanation, there's just like a brief cut to Azon. He's just like crossing his arms and not like reacting to anything, but it just cuts to him. And then it cuts back and just goes on like nothing happened.
I would love it if it cuts to him and he's blown away by that. He's just like, is he using chicken to make chicken stock? Well, he's blown away by the notion, like, independently. He's like, he's using chicken stock to make, like, chicken to make chicken stock. He's just like, you did too. He's like, this is so innovative. He's like taking notes down. They're like, you already did it. This is what the series ends on, essentially. It's like, Soma's last, like, thing. He's like, I used the chicken to make chicken stock. And that's when, like, a zombie's just like, no!
The ultimate surefire killer move! Une gets really excited when she observes that Megashima is going to be using peanuts and a shit ton of red peppers. And he's like, yeah, he'll use peanuts to bring out every last drop of deliciousness of red peppers.
It's like,
I'm drunk!
It's like, aren't you supposed to be representing a very prestigious, like, organization right now?
But we cut over to what Rindo's doing then, because she's chopping up the alligator into little chunks, and then mixing them with the seasoning and stuff. And I love the expression she's making as she's, like, mixing them in with seasoning. She's just like,
It's just the way she goes from one to the other in such quick succession. Like, it's in the next page too. She has that panel where she's got like the fangs and she's just like, I feel bad because I'm stealing Kuga's shtick. And then the next panel, so they're like, all right, Mr. Walk, let's see what you can do or whatever. It's just like, I just love Rindo at this point.
And they observe that she's also using a crap ton of red pepper in her dish. Very intense shot of her just dumping a bag into her freaking wok, too. Mega Shun was like, I figured you would do that. You were not going to make some dainty dish with delicately matched flavors. But peppers as a theme is easy to guess. You'd pile them on like there's no tomorrow. And I figured I'd better match power for power, or you'd roll right over me. And Megashima does this, rather, Rindo does this really weird thing, because she's like, oh man, how dare you talk to, like, you know, a gal inside and out like that. Of course, you do know me quite well. She's kind of, like, blushing while she grins at him.
Actually, I like this a lot, because she seems to be implying that they have a close relationship, which would make sense.
Yeah.
They're two of the top three chefs in the school. And they're third-year students apiece, so they've obviously spent a lot of time with one another, getting to know one another. So I do like kind of the hidden hints to, you know, what kind of relationship they share.
It's kind of weird just because as much of Rindo as we've seen up to this point, it's weird to see her being kind of flirty, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know which way I'm trying to take it. I could definitely see how it's flirty, and one way I'm trying to see it almost is just, like, the one time we've kind of seen legitimate, like, sort of, like, earnest feelings from her. Because she's almost always usually just, like, over the top or being silly. You don't get very much of her being, I guess, kind of real in a way. Mm-hmm. So I kind of try to read as that, but it definitely does also come off a little bit flirty. Maybe they did have some kind of romantic fling, who knows? But I just like the idea of suggesting there's a hidden past there, and maybe we'll find out a bit more of that. I mean, they've kind of shown there's been a lot of connections between members of the council with Ishiki and Glasses Girl.
Kinokuni.
Who cares? She's gone. I assume I don't have to remember her name anymore.
Do you remember the Rondo guy? What's his name?
Julio?
Oh, very good. Okay.
I only remember that
because nobody remembers Ponytail Girl. Don't worry about her.
I was trying to remember if they actually... Yeah, they did actively give her name, but...
They said what her name was, but she got beaten as soon as she had been introduced, so...
Yeah.
But Rindo makes an observation as they're both getting really intense when they're preparing their dishes, because she says, you know, it's been a really long time since you got serious, hasn't it? Because before, you were always like, challenges and stuff don't interest me. So what changed? What made you decide to join Somoyuki Hira's team? And Megashima says, rather ambiguously, you could say I got infected by some of his passion. We get a flashback of Soma recruiting their allies for this 8-on-8 team battle. And, you know, he reached out to Ishiki first, and Ishiki said, oh, I'm already on my way there. I was actually in on it with Joichiro and Dojima right from the start, and so it looks like our plan to get this Shokugekyoin worked perfectly. Kuga was basically there on the same page. Like, I've already heard the same thing from Ishiki. I know what's going on, and, you know, you're not going to get anywhere without the great Terunori Kuga on your team. And Mimasaka was like, yeah, you know, I owe you one, so I'll get started on doing my anti-council image training so I can be prepared for this. But when they reached out to Megashima, he was just like, nah.
I love the way it goes across, because it's just like, oh, hey, Soma, I already heard about it. I've made plans to come there with Dojima, and we're on our way right now. And then it's like, to Kuga, and it's like, really? You're calling now? I already heard all about this, and there's no way you're not getting my help. And then it's to Subaru, and he's just like, well, I do owe you one, so let's do it. And someone's like, man, it's going great. Let's just keep this momentum going and call our last guy. Just, no, click. And that's it. It's like,
nah, click.
It's just like, All right, let's, yeah, there is, like, that weird tension of just, like, the will he join? But, like, obviously he has, but it is kind of curious, like, what led him there. Again, this is the dude who's probably been the biggest mystery within the council.
Right.
Because we know the least about him, but there's obviously a lot going on because he's switched from the council, joined with Soma's team, and kind of the more we find out, the more things it feels like we kind of need to learn. So, I like this chapter for the most part. Again, I think right now Rindo is just killing it, just being the most, like, interesting kind of character in Jump, like, just chapter to chapter. At this point, I'm just like, God, if she loses and we don't get more of her, I'm gonna be so infuriated. I'm like, look, I'm sorry, Megashima, you seem cool, but you're going up against...
Villain of the year, Megashima.
Like, you're just...
For depriving us of Rindo.
It's like, look, I don't hate you, but you're going up against Daniel Bryan during the Yes Movement. It's just, you're not going to get over right now. I'm sorry.
He just hits a spear on her and pins her.
I'm like, no! They're like, sorry, we really wanted to capitalize on Dave Bautista's Hollywood career. Yeah, we really wanted to capitalize on Megashima's acting career, so he won the Royal Rumble. It's not a personal thing. Don't worry, we're sure you're going to love the
movie. He just raises an eyebrow, and you see, like, Rindo Taito Rain stop.
They're like, you're going to love the Megashima versus Takumi main event we have for the final Shokugeki. They're like, no, I don't want
this! No, it turns out Takumi's getting booed, too. we have nobody getting cheered.
Ah, see, this is where we get those really obscure wrestling references in. Not that the references are obscure, but we're now burying them within manga references now. Good times.
Oh, man. All right. Let's move on from here to Dr. Stone.
We're doing Dr. Stone across accounts.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. Okay, I forgot to update my normal list. So, across account. It's the last chapter of this Jumpstart. We finished up Chudon's Jumpstart last week.
And
this,
now, guys,
chapter...
Guys, remember, I know I kind of didn't bring it up during Shudan very much. Who gives a fuck? That was garbage. If you want to keep Cross account in the magazine, you got to go in now. I'm just going to give you guys the link so you guys can all go in. Make sure you vote this like a 10 out of 10. You want this in the series. We don't have this kind of dynamic in like a man and a woman in Jump anymore. Really just want to kind of get that out there. This is kind of the innovation that Jump's been craving for so, so long. The sort of tasteful storytelling that we really want to kind of push and emphasize.
The kind of relationship that'll take us into 2020.
Yeah, the kind of woke storytelling that really just brings us into this new millennium. The layers is what I really want to keep seeing. The different layers.
They're really insightful. The portrayal of social media.
Just the way they managed to tastefully create this female character doesn't feel exploitive at all. The sensitivity really is what I love about it. Really emphasizes.
There are going to be some people who have never heard of the series who are going to be really confused.
So, guys, you understand. It's a series where a guy shit posts on Twitter and he gets a Japanese idol to fall in love with him. I think I've covered it pretty quickly, actually.
Basically, yeah. I mean, it's quite appropriate you call it shitposting, considering she fucking calls herself Poophead.
Oh, my God.
I mean, this is the kind of fucking series that we deserve in a world where we make an emoji movie, so. All right. With that out of the way, I will say this is probably the one chapter of Crossing Out that I felt like anything positive for. It's damningly faint praise, I know, but it was like, I actually got a feeling that was similar, I think, to the one that I was intended to have in response to reading the chapter, basically. We pick up where we left off last time with Daichi confiding in Nanoka that he's going to be meeting her, at a handshake event. Of course, neither of them know each other, beyond their, aliases online. So he doesn't know that he's actually telling Nanoka, I'm going to meet you. So Nanoka agonizes over this for a little bit because she's like, oh my gosh, you know, we're going to be meeting face to face. This is, you know, going to be so strange. And Daichi's completely oblivious to the fact. And Nanoka's like, oh no, I'm really nervous. I know that there's no way he's going to find out, but you know, you're my first friend that I've ever had and I don't want to lose you as a result of this. But at the same time, you know, I want to actually see you for myself. You know, I only know you through social media, so I want to know who you actually are. And She knows a surprising amount about him, actually, already. This is, in a different context, this could really be an effective lesson in, you know, how to avoid being catfished, because she's already like, let's see, Mr. Harmful, he's 15 years old like me, he's short, and he's an otaku. And she says it's going to be hard to identify him, but she successfully does so. Nick. Because she's just following his Twitter feed as he's waiting in line and getting close to her.
Nick, you're proposing that this series address a negative aspect of social media.
Which it doesn't ever.
It's not. It's a tool for people to fall in love.
I will like have probably end up really eating a lot of crow if they end up doing something like, oh, Mr. Harmful ends up meeting and feeling sorry for someone that he shit-talked on Twitter or some shit like that.
I think, look, in a perfect world, this series also probably going to get canceled, what, 18 chapters, something like that, probably. So who knows if they get that long. But I would assume, unless the series is completely just brain-dead on its own concept, you do have to eventually get to that point where the main character has to be like, yeah, I need to apologize for using this, like, secret account to, like, just shit on my classmates and, like, to talk about how they're all such phonies and things like that. Like, eventually that has to come about. He has to learn. Like, this would be like, it's like that Doctor Strange thing. And it's like, yeah, he never actually learns to stop being a pompous asshole. He just gets all the magic powers and just continues being like, out of my way, plebeians. I've got magic now. You know, and just uses it to push people out of the way. It's like, no, he has to learn.
But he came to barter, Chris.
Bargain.
Oh, sorry. True. It's also kind of weird because, I mean, I know what this is meant, what this means, like, actually, when she says this, because she's saying to herself as she's, like, standing up on stage, getting ready for the handshake event, she's like, he's watching me. From where? What part of me? Is she thinking to herself, like, is he staring at my tits?
It absolutely is what it is, because it's the only shot that's a full page with, like, a down, like, from below viewpoint, so it emphasizes her curves. I can somewhat get the notion of that, but it's weirdly kind of brought out in this scenario that really was supposed to, I think, feel more, like, romantically charged than erotically charged.
Yeah.
It's also strange, because, like, how would he be checking out your ass if your fucking face, like, your back's against the thing?
Right.
A bill. But it's just a weird thing to, like, point out in that moment. But,
and also she knows how he's looking at her because he's told her how he fucking feels about Nanoka.
I guess maybe that's one thing that isn't brought up at, because the only, like, part of the conversation we've ever heard is him saying, like, she's got a gorgeous smile. Maybe there was a scene later on where he's just like, oh, man, I just want to fucking blow my load all over them tits. It's just like, ew. Ew. Like, that's all she texts back. Ew. I gross.
And I think, and again, I think that this idea in a more mature series could actually handle this idea very effectively. Like, if this weren't just a cheesecakey aimed at 15-year-olds, well, you know, aimed at Daichi's, basically, kind of series, wish fulfillment, that you could probably actually tell this kind of story where it's like, hey, there's this person that I kind of am interested in, but also I'm nervous about how he might be looking at me and judging me. You know, he sees me as a fan, and I know how some fans look at me, and I really am curious, but also nervous about how he feels about me as a fan. Like, is it, you know, if I knew about it, would I be kind of charmed by it, or would I be creeped out by it? Like, I think that that's something that you could actually make something out of. And, of course, this goes for the much more, like, straightforward route, so.
What's kind of disturbing about this, it's almost somewhat similar to that level that came up in Freezing, where it's like, she's thinking, like, what part of me is he staring at? Note, when she meets him in this chapter, spoilers, that doesn't come up. So that scene right there is only for the audience to get that view of her and to almost think that. It's not a concern that's brought up to then be addressed in any way, shape, or form. It's almost just a method, a vehicle for the author to draw her in a way that kind of shows off the curves a little bit and is meant to be titillating, I imagine. So it's somewhat kind of like a shitty statement in a way, but I mean, I don't have high expectations for this series at this point, so I'm somewhat used to it.
So she's getting more and more nervous the closer that Mr. Harmful is to meeting her, until eventually, like, because apparently he's just, because she's checking everything on her smartwatch, basically, and eventually gets to the point where he's just like, okay, I'm the next person to go up, and she's like, oh my god, no, and Daichi shows up in front of her, and she's being like, so she's like, I could tell the moment I saw him, this boy must be Mr. Harmful. It's true that he's as tall as me. It's also true that he has a crazy video game callus. And more than anything else, it's so true that, oh man, he just totally like wanked one out right before he shook my hand, didn't he?
Oh, Jesus gross. Christ. Oh, it's
oh,
everywhere.
Oh my god. Oh.
Oh, this isn't going any of the way I thought it would.
But she was like, oh man, it's so true that he looks completely harmless. Whoever named him Mr. Harmless, yeah, you are genius. Or observe the obvious, whatever. So, look, he does this, you know, kind of awkward little semi-fan confession thing, which the people behind him in line make fun of him for. It's like, man, all y'all go fuck yourselves. You're the exact same way. Showing up to shake this 15-year-old girl's hand when some of y'all look 30. Shut the fuck up.
I mean, there's literally page 140 shows a montage of different people who come to, like, speak to her and show snippets of what they say, and almost all of them are along the same lines of somebody saying, like, I made a song for you, I came all the way from America, I bought 100 of your photo books. I guess him...
Which, by the way, there's no way that someone would fly all the way to America for this.
Yeah, but... especially if it's like, also like, wait, you flew all the way from America to meet and greet a 15-year-old Japanese pop star? This is very suspicious, sir. This is very strange.
I mean, I also wish that there had been more of a kind of balance among them. Like, we see a couple fans, like, there's a grandfather there with his grandson, and who's like, you know, like, 8 years old or something. They're like, we're both big fans of you. It's like, oh, that's adorable. Yeah. There's a girl about the same age there who's like, I'm totally posting about this for real. But there are so many where it's just, eh. Look, I'm not going to get into this big, like, discussion of how creepy the idol business is, but it is creepy. Let's just leave it at that. Anyhow. Nonoka finally meets Daichi in person. She has a flashback to when Mr. Harmful explained who his crush was. That he said it was, oh yeah, it's Nanoka Satsuki. And she was like, what? It's me! You privately said, oh, you mean that Nanoka Satsuki? And he's like, yeah. And he says, the moment she smiled on screen, I fell in love with her. My first crush is an actress in the film. And it's kind of funny, right? But she's like, no, I won't laugh at you. Even though the person you like is not the real me, but rather me as an actress. Thanks to that, I could begin to love being my actress self.
Next message is just like, that's how I blew my first load. She's like, I'm going to turn off Twitter for now. Click. She's like, oh, man, I'm getting pretty tired. I'm going to go to bed. Don't worry, no last message.
So in response to Daichi's very earnest, like, oh, I'm so inspired by you kind of thing, she takes his hand and presses it to her forehead, and she's like, you're the first person who's ever said anything like that to me. No, he's not. And so, yeah, you know, Daichi just like, you know, says, oh, thank you, and he's on his way, and they go their separate ways back home, and Nanoka's just thinking to herself, well, she's actually like having a conversation now as Poophead with Mr. Harmful, and he's like, oh yeah, she was exactly the person that I always imagined. So great that I could see her in real life. Oh, I'm pretty sure that a miracle like this will never happen again. And Poophead says, don't wait for a miracle to happen. You gotta make it happen. Never give up. Maybe one day you might be able to see her again. And that sentiment, I think, is probably the most effective part of the chapter, is that, you know, she basically got what she wanted out of this whole thing. And she is actually having that show up in the way that she actually interacts with Daichi online. And that's also a really good sentiment just in general. You know, don't wait for things to happen. Don't, you know, be wistfully hoping that one day you'll have, you know, hey, you want something big out of life, then go make it, go out and make it happen. Which she could do if she really wanted to.
Yeah, she didn't have to, she hasn't had to earn this.
She really could have just, like, I don't know, passed on some message so that he would know. But then, of course, you know, the series will be over because he would know the secret. But
Nick, I want to propose an alternate ending to this chapter. So it goes essentially the same way it does now. Ends with them. He's on a train, riding back, gets that message, never give up. And that's the one, like, we pan away and we pan over to, like, a newspaper and you see the date on it. And I don't know if it, like, an accident like this exists in real life, but we create a fictional accident that exists on a train that day, and we realize this is in the past, and he's on this train that's fated to just get into a massive accident where everyone dies. And it's just like, holy shit, it was a twist! It was a tragic movie all along! Was the Remember Me movie where it turns out, like, he was in the fucking Twin Towers at the end? And it was that was, like, the twist of the movie?
Or what was that one movie that was, like, from 2010 or something like that, where the guy, like, jumped into somebody's body or something like that? Oh, God.
Oh, Source Code.
Source Code, yeah.
Jake Gyllenhaal, yeah.
Yeah. That was a good movie, actually.
Ultimately, I want the ending to be that this train ride back home doesn't go well for him, and it's, like, a horrible casualty. Look, it's not just Shudan, guys. I want dark endings to everything in this series, this magazine that I don't enjoy, basically.
Bye, cross a cow, never think of you again, sure. Someone in the chat did bring up a point. It is a really good art in this series.
I love
such
the art.
It's such a waste. It's such a goddamn waste.
I absolutely adore the art in it. It's the biggest thing I can praise. Like, it's got a real elegance to it at points. It's probably one of the biggest reasons that I kind of get annoyed at the series the way it does. It takes these good aspects to it, like this idea of implementing the influences social media has on relationship and this incredible art, and just bogs it down with wish fulfillment love story that relies on a lot of cheesecake at times, and just playing the idea of, like, man, look at this perfect girl, and she's just so effortlessly beautiful, but she really likes just, like, hanging out in a beanbag chair, eating Doritos and playing video games, because she's just that cool with stuff, right?
Right,
just, like,
right.
She's totally in love with this super stringy nerdy kid who just does, no one understands him, and it's like, fuck off.
Yeah, she's someone that I could hang out. We could play video games all day. We would be really low maintenance, and then we would have lots of hot sex afterwards, you know. And
I think this series is going to be done in 16, 18 chapters, whatever. But if this series somehow survives to, like, 50 chapters, something, if I come in chapter 50 and she hasn't had one issue, like, she's still just, like, this perfect character, I'd lose my mind.
It's one of those things where it's like, it's not a bad premise, honestly. It's just too obvious about the way it goes about it, really. Too obvious and too low as common denominator. So, alright, now we're gonna talk about Dr. Stone. And, right, last time, using a block and tackle system, or just pulleys, as it was called, but it's block and tackle. Shut up. Senku saved, Kohaku, the, primitive girl that attacks Tsukasa because she has 20/.08 or some weird, ridiculous shit vision. After having been saved by, Senku, Kaga's like, oh, yeah, I think that I really like you. And Senku kind of pulls, like, an old school Jughead on her. He's just like, ah, oh, man, romance really messes up your brain. It makes you super irrational. I don't have time for it.
I do like the idea that Senku's, like, almost a little robotic in his like the way he thinks of just, like, emotion should never come in. Like, it just clouds up, like, legitimate judgment. But it does come off a little strange considering, like, two chapters ago, he's just like, there's no scientific reason why I should, like, raise this flag in celebration, but I'm going to do it because my best friend wants me to, and I know it's a way for us to send our feelings to
those before cave hoes, okay?
Yeah, he's just like, but this cave wench, who cares?
And she clarifies what she means by that. She's like, no, I'm not like in love with you. I'm saying that like, I admire what you can do. And so, yeah, I'm going to cooperate with you. And so he's like, oh, good. A brain clouded by love is the most irrational kind. It leads to nothing but trouble. I can only imagine that this is just from his observations of Taiju through their entire lives.
I mean, yeah, if you had a dude whose fucking, like, relationship was entirely that, like, stupidly one, like, one way, this is our destiny.
How am I ever going to confess to you, Zaria?
Oh, man, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do it. Oh, I'm so torn up about it. Just him being like, you know, you could just solve this bashfully by talking to her. Oh, I don't know if I could do that. Just like, I'm going to be over here with my Bunsen beakers and shit.
Oh, man. So, Senku observes because he's like curls up in his sleeping bag while Konoha is crouched against a tree and she's got freaking knives in her hands even while she's curling up to sleep. And so he says, so you knew humans sleep with blades in hand? And she gets really defensive over what he had said earlier because she's like, oh yeah, it's pretty obvious I don't have love on the brain, right?
I love that response too. Like, it's just this pose of like her sleeping with knives and he's like, so you do that? She's like, yeah, bitch. Guess I'm not this love-torn idiot you thought I was, huh? not so emotional thinking am I now, huh? You want to be cut?
But she says something that's very wise. She says, you know, I'm curious about your ways, but I don't fully trust you yet. So, you know, it's the habit that I've had from having to protect myself for my entire life. So, you know, don't be offended. You know, I'm just watching out for myself. And Senku's like, eh, whatever, go to sleep. I'm not gonna be somebody who would try to attack a lioness like you and just rolls over in the sleeping bag. She's like, what do you mean lioness?
I don't know why she keeps taking it as an insult. Like, he keeps saying it and she's just like, I'm not a lioness. I'd be like, I mean, I think it's a pretty dope term.
Yeah, if they end up being a couple, he's gonna call her that all the time. She's gonna love it.
Yeah.
You know, some time goes by, you know, goes the next day. So, he says, like, yeah, I need to oppose that Tsukasa guy, so that's why I'm building a kingdom of science. And she's like, you mean your sorcery? Well, first I need manpower. And she says, okay, well, come with me home to my village. We can do that after I fetch some hot spring water. And, she takes this huge mason jar and, fills it up with water. And she's like, yeah, you know, this will make a fine bath. It's great for rejuvenation. And he's like, why would a vigorous lioness like you need rejuvenation? You're perfectly healthy. And she's like, I'm not a lioness!
She's like, chill out here, Senku. What's... Doth protest too much after a while.
So she's carrying it back to her village. And so she even says kind of wistfully, like, oh, yeah, you know, it kind of sucks, you know, it's for my older sister and... She really slows me down. She's been really sick lately. If I could only take her place and give her this healthy body of mine, I would. Sugar doesn't really say anything in response to that. He's just like, hey, you know, that pot's only got about 50 liters. So how many times have you gone back and forth carrying that thing day after day? And it's like, eh, it's my daily training, so whatever. But she struggles in order to, and stumbles with it and almost drops it, and Senku helps her catch it, and he says, hey, you're not totally healed from earlier, so it'd really suck if you push yourself too hard, so let me help you out here. Let me do this for you. And he collapses immediately.
I do love it being hit immediately at the bottom of the hill, the fucking thing toppled over, and just her like, you really fucked it up. He's just like, why is everyone but me in this world a fucking power monster?
But he, you know, crafts this frickin' sled, basically, for them to ride down the hill on instead. You know, it just kind of assembles it from the leftovers of the pulley system that he set up before. And it falls apart at the bottom of the hill. But they make it down in much quicker time than struggling all the way down. And it's also just like a cool little shot of them riding this weird vehicle down the hill, too. They arrive at Kohaku's village. And she says, yeah, we've got exactly 40 people here, not counting, I guess, I think she says that's not counting the children and elders. And oddly enough, we actually just get introduced to all of them immediately.
I'm going to tell you right now, Chalk the dog better be a fucking main character, because that
you better get his peanuts.
You better. If something bad happens to Chalk Dick, I'm gonna lose my fucking shit.
Also, the guy in the bottom row, second from the left, doesn't have a name.
Just the dude who's just like crazy, intense, staring eye dude, no name. Also, I like Sueka, the dude who just got like a fucking chestnut helmet. He's like, looks like a motherfucking Pokemon at that point.
Or Suzu, who's got, like, rope tied around her mouth. Yeah. There's definitely some weird-looking designs in this group. I'm sure we're not going to meet all of them, but there's a few that are just like, that one looks weird.
It's interesting. We don't always bring it up, but I was reading the author comments at the end of the chapter, and the author comments for Dr. Stone, at least the ones we get in our in the U.S. version, is from the artist's name, who I'm blanking on right now. But he mentions it, like, it was really daunting to draw 40 characters, and this is the same dude who did Sunken Rock, Boichi.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, it was really daunting to do 40 characters, but a lot of them are girls, so I'm pretty excited about that. It's like, I know you are.
Steve, man. Can you imagine if we went to Steven, hey, draw 40 characters. How many of them can I get boobs?
It's like, how many of them could be in this, gangbang I've already created in my mind? I'm like, I mean, all of them, I guess. He's like,
I guess. You got it. We love you, Steven. Thank you.
He's like, I'm giving them all robot arms.
Okay. Oh,
go for it, brother.
Go for it. So, Senku thinks about this for a little bit, and he's thinking, okay, so judging by the looks of this village, hey, that Kohaku and all these people don't know anything about modern civilization, so this has to be an entire village of people who are descendants of those revived from stone. There must have been a first generation at some point, maybe a few hundred years ago. A few people broke out all at once, but, you know, how did that happen? So was there a guy who was like me who created a revival fluid? If he did that, then that would mean that he would have probably passed on his teachings to his descendants, and they would actually know about science. So where did these people come from? How is there an entire village here? And, interesting little thing, yeah.
There's one element that is somewhat alarming to me, and this might be nothing. You know, we've read a lot of One Piece. We know that there are a lot of characters that look like Nami that aren't Nami. But I was noting, like, a lot of the female characters seem to have, like, the same eyes. And I was like,
the big eyes.
This isn't, like, a crazy inbreeding result, is it? Like, they're all, like, yeah, these are all, like, my distant cousins. By distant, I mean, like, once removed. Like, over and over again. Like, uh-oh.
Well, a few of the female characters do look different from that, though.
Right? Oh, yeah, they're surprised.
Like Beryl.
But, like, we heard Kohaku has an older sister, which I'm assuming is Ruri. But then it's also,
probably.
Like, it could be Sango, it could be Sapphire, it could be Garnet.
Could be Shirogane.
Could be Ruby, although she has different eyes. She got a younger sister in Suzu.
Could be Lapis Lazuli, could be...
Oh, God, what
could
were
be,
the...
could be Paranoc, could be Steven, you know?
I was like, what were the other stones from Del Toro Quest?
Not where I was going, but okay. but it is an interesting point that Senku brings up, and I imagine that there might be some sort of big reveal about this down the line. Maybe it's not an obvious answer. Maybe the reason why humanity turned to stone was so that a new generation could arise and start things over or something like that. Anyhow, Senku arrives with Kohaku. A couple of the young men come out with spears to attack him. Let's see. Kinro and Ginro are their names. And so Kohaku fights them off in her weird, super acrobatic flipping through the air and putting her legs over her head way. She's like, hey, you know, leave him alone. You know, this guy saved my life. And they say, hey, you know, we don't allow outsiders in here, and those are rules, so stop. No, he's not allowed inside. So, okay then, fight me. You know, the advantage is yours. I must be in big trouble. And I love the very, like, whatever, I'll just kick your asses, look in her eyes as she says this, and how scared that they get. It really does make her seem like a badass. Mm. But Senku achieves a more peaceful way of going about it, which is that he just picks up a bit of water from their big pot and combines it with some soap that he's got, and he blows some soap bubbles through his fingers, and the guys are immediately like, what sorcery is this? He's stabbing the bubbles.
These flying jewels!
And so Senku gets really, really, like, kind of asshole-ish about that, because he's like, oh, they're that primitive, huh? Perfect. They'll all be mine. I'll have the power of science and 40 people to boot. Once I recruit this much to my cause, get excited. He's like, I don't know if I like you anymore.
She's like, this, your motivations suddenly seem more sinister than I thought.
And she says that, well, hey, if you want to do that, you're going to have to recruit Chrome. And, I mean, it's a man that I think you'll find useful. And also, he's the most easygoing of us all. So, this is a rather sudden kind of development that we've gotten in the last couple of chapters. Like, I mean, it seems as though it was just... I mean, gosh, it must have been only around a month and a half ago or something like that that we even knew that there were, you know, humans outside of the main four characters that we met by that point. And now all of a sudden we've got this entire village introduced.
Yeah.
And very sudden development, but I'm so excited.
It's hard after, like, watching something like Walking Dead for a while to not see this group and just be like, this shit's like Alexandria. There's only going to be like three of you motherfuckers who are going to be important. The rest of you are all going to get eaten by zombies while you're doing stupid shit. You're all going to be like, oh, I fell. I can go for my gun, but I might just scream until the zombies get me. Ah! It's just like, God damn it, Argo! You were supposed to be somebody. None of you are black, so you're going to avoid that issue Walking Dead always had. It's a real concern, Nick. It took so long for there to be two black characters on the show at the same time. It was like a curse or something.
And no one got eaten.
Every time. Poor T-Dog got eaten, then they'd introduce Oscar. Then Oscar got just ceremoniously killed right as they introduced Tyrese.
That's actually one of the few scenes that I've seen from that show, is that because there was like some former black child star who got eaten because of some sort of revolving door thingy.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that. It's pretty brutal. There was like a series, I think in season 5, or maybe the end of season 4, where like, the three black cast, like male cast members in a row just got killed. Jesus, it had really reached a point where we're like, oh, okay, like, you know, we finally gotten over that weird thing where like a black guy would die and then another one would join into the group. And then it's just like, boom, there's in a row. God.
Gotta start over from scratch.
Basically.
All right. Okay. Well, let's go over to We Never Learn, I guess.
Yes. We Never Learn. Two chapters here. Chapter 20, or question 20, a genius is swayed by X in a blurry world. So
two chapters of We Never Learn, Chris. You know what that means.
Means one of them would be decent and the other one will be hot fan servicey garbage.
Pretty much.
So this one is the former in that, because the story starts off with Ogata's father accidentally breaking her glasses. He just wanted to kind of give her a hug and knocked them off her face and I guess stepped on them afterwards. So Ogata's like,
oh no, my collection of hammers, and he drops it on top of them.
Oh, I want to give you a hug and drop my collection of expensive anvils. She says, it's fine, I'll use my old glasses, but you're banned from ever coming within 3 meters of me. And I was like, aww. That's so mean. He just wants to give his daughter a hug. But this chapter's primarily about how Ogata is generally seen as very scary by her classmates, primarily because of her glasses. Just kind of creates that figure, that image that's imposing. So she's got a very angry expression on her face already because she doesn't like wearing these glasses.
She has to squint with them on.
Yes, she has to squint, so she always looks like she's kind of glaring too. So we go over to where Furuhashi is talking with Uega, and she's basically trying to like really lay it in, like, look, you can't just create space between you. That's not helping
this issue.
It doesn't. I don't know how you think a woman's brain works. It doesn't work the way you think it does. It's not like that. He's like, man, women are complicated.
Also, when did you change your hair? I'm not used to women doing things.
I'm so confused. So P's getting ready to leave. She's like, oh, I'll go with you. Trips, falls into him. It's a little bit like, oh no, I've fallen into his arms. Well, thank God, you know, nothing happens there, because if you just saw this, it would look really weird. And then, of course, Ogata had seen it. And she's in a bad mood already. She's kind of snapping at them. And Furuhashi's like, uh-oh, this isn't good. Like, she's gonna think that I'm making a move in. She's gonna be really angry about this. I've told her that I'm trying to help and support her. And she's like, I'll just have to, like, help her out too. And Ogata, meanwhile, is just like, can't see anything. Where are you fuckers? So she has to, like, grab onto Yuega's sleeve and basically, like, use him as a guide. And Furuhashi's like, good, this is my way. I'll make it up to you by basically, like, Yuega, you take her hand, you guide her around, I'll help, you know, push you guys closer together, essentially. Eventually they get into class, and Yuega's just like, I don't get it, why is she so angry, she seems to be really pissed off, what's going on? And then he notices finally that she's squinting, and he's like, you know, you could have just said something, you can't see with those glasses, can you? And she's like, doesn't matter, I don't care, I don't need people to help me out, I didn't want to bother anybody, and Yuega's like, look, you know, we're in this together. I'm here to support you. Just, like, tell us the stuff, and we'll figure out a way to make it so we'll be better. That's what I'm here for. And she's happy with that. So after class, she's like, take me to the library. And she actually takes her glasses off because she's like, doesn't matter if I have them on at this point.
Yeah.
It's actually hurting me to have them on. It's an old prescription. So I'm going to go without it. And as she's walking around, a bunch of kids in the class are like, hey, is that Ogata? She's a lot cuter without those glasses on. She's a real hottie. Hottie boom balati. And I guess she's just happy that she's like, hey, I'm getting some attention. But she actually still has that kind of like, I don't know what the term you would put. I guess innocence or naivety to it, where she's just like, she just like is questioning it. She's like, why do they like me more without my glasses on? Wiga's just like, oh, I guess they think you're cuter. She's like, what do you like? He's like, hubba da, hubba da, hubba da. Who's to say what like really is in today's modern society?
What's define the word like? This is a great study lesson, Ogata.
Webster's Dictionary would define the word like as, oh, there's the bell, gotta go. No, he basically does sort of make the notion of like, I think without. And she's like, oh, should I get contacts? And that's when Furuhashi's like, I'm going to really help you out. So, you know, forgive me, Yuega. I'm going to make it work. I'm making it up to my friend. So she pushes Yuega into her so they'll fall in together and embrace. But of course, it's a sexy, sexy embrace because he lands directly into her enormous boobs.
Yep.
Got to get that in there somewhere.
And she makes them wear signs afterwards, I guess?
Yes. So she... I believe, I don't know, actually this is the same day.
Like her dogs that she's shaming on Instagram or something?
Yeah. I thought it was the next day, but I guess actually it is. She just started wearing her glasses again. And then this is essentially like the time skip to be like, hey, they've resolved the conflict by telling each other what's happening. But yeah, she's essentially put shame sides on them. Her, Furuhashi is a war criminal and Yuega is a pervert.
I do really like that she's a war criminal.
It's just an extreme way of defining her crime.
One very on the nose and one just absurdly overstated.
And it sort of ends there with Furuhashi like crying, I'm so sorry, and Yuega being like, I don't get what you were trying to do. And she's like, just don't worry about it. And the final bit is just a shot of Takamoto in the library of her explaining she was there waiting for everybody because it's study time. And she's like, I wonder where everyone is. It's like, oh, this is such a sad like cliff note to this chapter. She's just there sadly.
It's okay, Chris. You got her peanuts.
I wanted her to get her peanut. We got a lot. That's a very careful phrase to say there, because as I noted with the Peanuts movie, it really does at times sound like the penis movie. And I really don't want it to be like, Takamoto needs to get her peanuts. Everyone's like, what?
I mean, that's what she wants, isn't it? This was a really, I thought it was actually a really nice chapter before we move on to the second one. I mean, oh, I can't see without my glasses, I'm Velma and I'm lost kind of thing. But
Jankies.
The fact that it kind of cuts it off so early with Yuega being like, oh, you can't see, why don't you say so? Hey, you know, you should have asked for help, was a really nice way of just addressing that and building on the interaction between them. Him actually having enough nerve to just file to, yeah, I guess you do look kind of better, you know, without them, honestly. because it shows, you know, a step forward in also in their relationship, not necessarily even in a romantic way, but in terms of, like, you know, if you're actually, like, comfortable with being, like, friends with each other, then you can more comfortably answer that kind of a question. So it's showing more how this study group is getting closer to each other the more that we go along. I mean, of course, obviously, we end on more jokey jokes, but that's nothing in comparison to the next chapter, so.
And it's ultimately a comedy series, first and foremost, so I expect that to take the center stage more often than not. I also do like how, because I was worried when Furuhashi trips into him that it was going to be like a like ignition of her feelings for him or something like
right,
that.
Right.
But she really is acknowledging like, ooh, this is kind of weird and uncomfortable. Hope nobody like misconstrues this. Like she really is fully still in the camp of like, I'm just going to support my friends. All right. So question 21 is the second chapter, the forbidden item that connects an ex-genius. And this chapter is about Uega getting a smartphone, because his family's super broke, but they won one in a contest with the sad explanation of, yeah, so we figured we'd share this phone together as a family. And I'm just like, oh, God.
Well, that's a new way of doing a family plan, I guess.
I guess maybe I would know this thing more, because I grew up relatively poor. I know the struggles of an imaginary Christmas, but I guess since we didn't grow up when cell phones were that common of a thing, I don't know the notion of, like, hey, we just have this one phone, like, one of those common pieces of appliances for our whole family that we'll just share. Just like I see that, I'm just like, oh no. And he's so happy. But, the joke here is that, you know, he doesn't get how technology works. He's clueless. He's just like,
it's absurd, honestly.
He's like looking at the user manual.
Like, I understand being naive about stuff, but you would think that a guy like Uega would have a certain level of intuition about this kind of thing. You know, there's all the kind of like, sort of stereotypical old person not used to technology things, but you expect young people to pick this up faster than this.
Yeah, he's seemingly, I don't know what he doesn't really try to explain what he has trouble with doing, because the example Takamoto does is like, here's how you do a search. And I'm like, how would you not understand how to, like, do you not understand how to unlock your phone? My mom had a stroke and she knows how to operate an iPhone relatively easily. Like, it can't be that bad.
Forget smartphones. Uega, have you never used a computer?
He's just like, I don't know where to go.
Is that like a book?
Takamoto gets on Google, and she brings up this study she found where they say if you study in the bath, it stimulates your brain's ability to effectively retain information. And then she kind of jokes like, but who would want to study in the bath? Ha ha ha, that's so silly. They're all trying to study. They're all studying. So, like, trying to get better grades. So, obviously, this chapter's all about how they all study in the bath this time. And wouldn't you know, coolest old Uega is not intending to with his new smartphone, but he's accidentally calling all the other girls while they're in the bath, too. And he doesn't want to bring it up, but because they're in the bath, that means they're naked. So he can't help but feel like he's naked along with them. This chapter is garbage.
It's so stupid.
It's such shameless garbage.
It's just a bunch of images of the girls in the bath and Uega calling them and then them imagining a scene of them sharing a bath. The first one, like, Fumito imagines them being, like, back-to-back in the bath, which is like, okay, fine, whatever. The second one is, like, Ogata, as if they're, like, sitting front-to-front, though, with, like, a table of study items between them. And then the last one, like, somehow Uruka puts their phone call on video mode. And it's just like, come on.
Well, it's weird, too, because the joke was supposed to be that Uega is bad with technology. But somehow the biggest, like, faux pas is made by Takamoto being dumb.
Yeah.
So she, or maybe he accidentally puts the video call on. No, she does. Her hand's shaking, so she puts it on speakerphone, but she accidentally hits it on video phone instead. So, it's a bit weird there. The only thing I guess I kind of want to note in the chapter is they continue, like, kind of building Ogata's dad as this comedic character, because when he accidentally calls Ogata, her dad answers, and he's just like, what is your business with my daughter? Oh, but I'm so happy you're helping her study. And then Ogata's like, Dad, get the fuck off my phone! I don't ever answer my phone! And I'm like, I'm sorry, I just wanted to make sure you're okay. You're not allowed to go anywhere near me 5 meters now! And it's like this dad who really just loves his daughter and she keeps banning the distance she can get close to her. But yeah, it's just a way to kind of have this like joke of like, oh, Yuiga accidentally is thinking about her in the bath, or oh, he's accidentally doing this now. And that's primarily the whole thing.
That's basically it.
Oh, and then he drops his phone in the bath.
Yeah.
Because that, I don't know why that was the part that was so tragic to me.
And Iruka, like, it's very explicitly shown that she looks at, that she sees Yuiga's dick. Because, like, she puts the phone to the side of her, and when she puts it on speakerphone, she puts it on a video, and Yuiga doesn't understand technology, so he doesn't know that he could just hang up the call, or cover it up, or
turn it around,
a billion different things. He doesn't understand any of this, so he's just like shouting at her, and he's like, and she's like, what? What's going on? I can't see because of the shampoo. And then she sees the screen, and she sees that Yuiga has somehow managed to get basically a full body shot, and she very explicitly goes, look slower.
Yeah.
And yeah, then he drops the phone, and no one's got to get fixed. And
you know, I mean, not for nothing. If I was a school, I really would be like, hey, look, I get there's a lot of good intentions. There's a lot of unintentional, but a lot of sexual harassment going on in this study group, Yuiga. I really, look, I love you, kid, but this is, you're showing your dick to them, they're showing their entire naked bodies to you, it's very you're just supposed to teach them fucking science and humanities, that's all it is. You don't, for the love of God, just stop, just, please stop making my job so much harder.
Alright. Well, that said, let's move on to the Promised Neverland. Last time,
looked like, as though, I want to just note off the top here. Maybe I just haven't noticed this previously. Norman's still included in the cover page of characters.
Well, yeah. He's Yuno.
he's persistently in these chapters.
I am wondering how long he's going to be separated from the group, because it does seem like it's going to be Emma and Ray for quite a while at this point.
I mean, there is still definitely the, notion that he is dead. Like, there is still no confirmation that suggests he's 100% alive. It's still very much an up-in-the-air thing. So I wonder if, like, the notion of keeping him in there is a way to keep him into, like, the reader's minds. Or
consciousness.
Or if it's just a way to kind of establish, like, here are the main characters. Because Mom's also included in there, and we know she's not going to be doing anything right now. She's at the farm, so.
Right. I guess it's also because, like, there hasn't been a character introduced that's currently important enough to...
What about fucking wacky horse monster thing there?
Like, they don't have names yet, Chris.
I would, dude, call him that. Wacky eight-legged horsey dude. Ado Manito. That's his name. That's my cool name for the horse. Put it in Jump. Right. Jeff, I know you're listening. You send that right to Sasaki-san. You give that right to him. You said, hey, Ado Manito is the name of this horse going forward. So saith the Jeff. And then you slap a digivice down the table and just quietly walk away without saying anything. And he'll know. Do it! I hear you not doing it. Do it! Start getting that digivice ready. Ado Manito, write it down.
Karen. Anyway, so Ado Manito and his rider save Ray, they basically just kind of get away. A smoke cloud seems to pop up and hides their escape. The dog-like demons are like, oh yeah, the smoke's affected our sense of smell, we can't track them. Oh, then use your eyes! They've gotta be footprints, you know, find them, search for the other children. And, obviously the pursuers are really, really pissed off about this. The leader of the group says, whoever it was, I'll shred him to pieces! I must get them back! All the children, including 81194, and the ones that are alive or dead, belong to our farm. I'll find and retrieve them all. And in anger, he just kind of, as he spins around, he slashes his sword and cuts this huge tree behind him apart. I think this might turn into a battle series after all, Chris. What the fuck?
Maybe. I don't know.
terrifying. Ray is basically on the verge of passing out at this point, as you know, he's being carried into this cavern, and he's like, "What? You know, where are we going? What direction are we going in? Who is this? Why did he save me? Could it be my nerd?
Could it be my who needs
I'm awake!
I'm, in my mind, creating a new language. It doesn't require words. It just uses grunts and suggestions to create an entire language. So it'd be,
oh, I'm awake! Damn it, did I miss America's Next Top Model again?
Oh my god, for a moment I almost thought about not using Vinyl Records for my music! Oh,
oh no. That guy was just a dream.
I was almost gonna listen to CD or an MP3. Oh god, what a fool I was. Time to buy the Police albums on vinyl somehow.
So, he realizes he's in a cave. And he looks around like, oh, what happened? Someone saved me and I blacked out. And he picks up this very odd-looking lantern and starts looking around the cave that he's in. And he's like, oh, my stuff is gone. I have no idea of telling what time it is, if it's day or night. All right, I have to figure this out. You know, a bunch of questions are just rushing through his mind because he has no idea where he is, where the others are, why they were taken here. And as he's stumbling around, he basically just flat out trips over Emma as she's also been placed in a sleeping bag. And he's like, Emma! Emma! Wake up! I want to open my crescent presents now!
I feel like she got a room with a lot more light in it, which is very uncalled for. Children of my variety who have baby members really need a lot of light to help increase their development. She's like, it's only bright in here because you brought your stupid lantern. Actually, this lantern is really innovating the way we use portable light technology.
Oh my god, I'm going back to sleep.
She's like, just kill. Oh, why couldn't I have taken the other ear off too?
It's like, imagine like that shot of her looking up at him and seeing his face. And she's like, oh no, not you.
She's like, god damn it. Ray, please don't mention anything about baby memories. Of course, I don't need to do it. I'm not a one-note character. See all these fidget spinners I made out of wood sticks and leaves in the woods? So innovative.
I thought you said that they took all your stuff. You weren't awake for that. You weren't awake for my crazy narration.
You don't know what things you weren't there for, you weren't present for, because I do, but I have baby memories. She's like, is that how baby memories work?
Oh, we're hugging now. Oh, okay.
Oh, it's one of those moments. Okay.
Yes, hugging, not strangling. I'm just trying to feel, gauge how weak your kidneys are.
So, neither of them know what's going on. We get actually a brief glimpse, because I'm so used to just seeing Emma from the front with her little antenna. Don't really see her from the back too much to see that she's got a back antenna too. You can see it at the bottom of page 75. There. So, they basically share what information that they know. Which is, okay, so there was a guy in a hood, there was a girl in a hood, they saved us separately and brought us both here. Emma's like, yeah, you know, I think she took care of me. Her voice was tender and beautiful. And Ray's like, well, you can't judge just from that. Come on.
It's like a shot of her like, alright, now Emma, if you need anything, we'll just take care of yourself, alright? Alright, I'm gonna be here in the other room with my other very delicate friend there. Hey! What's going on in there? Is she asleep yet? Oh no, she'll be asleep in just a moment there. Alright! Yeah, we're
so kind and tender and beautiful.
We call ourselves the Angels of the Forest or something. Something stupid like that. Anyway, like,
we're gonna eat them later, we're gonna eat them later, okay.
Yeah, alright. Hey, if you wanna wake up and marinate yourself in this lemon herb garlic sauce, that'd be great.
Could you just like take a bath in this spice pot?
Yeah, so I don't know how you did it in the farm here. We bathe in barbecue sauce, you know, for a couple hours. Get both sides.
Shave your hair with this broth.
It's chicken broth. It's pretty inventive. I don't know if you heard
about
it.
Chicken.
She's like, holy shit. He's like, yeah, I know. We're pretty innovative with demons. I mean, people, normal people.
Emma is kind of optimistic about the whole situation. She says, hey, you know, maybe it's Mr. Minerva's doing. You know, maybe they saved us. You know, we're supposed to be food for demons and stuff. So if we were saved, then maybe that's why. But Ray is still suspicious. And you can kind of see where both of them are coming from the get-go, which is, you know, it's just the two of us here in this cave, and I can't find the others. And on the other hand, is like, yeah, but our lives were saved by it. So it's an understandable difference in views.
I also like it because it does, like, reinforce who these two different characters are, because we've known Emma is the more emotional thinker of the two of them. She tends to think in a positive manner more often than not. She was the one who was like, we're getting all the kids out no matter what. Whereas Ray was the one who was always like, we gotta, like, logically not save them. So it makes sense that Emma would be the one who'd be more inclined to think better of this person, whereas Ray, who's just this pessimist, would be the one to be like, I don't know, it's probably pretty shifty.
Hmm. So they come across the cloaked girl that saved Emma earlier. And she's like, oh, yeah, are you feeling better? And, all right, the bleeding's stopped, your fever's down, the herbs must have worked. She also takes their hands, and she says, oh, yeah, you ran away, right, from the farm. Well, you'll be okay as long as you're here, you're safe, so just rest up for tonight. And it was like, I was right! But she also says, hey, where is everyone? You know, all the kids that were with me. And the girl says, oh, yeah, they're just over here. We're eating food together. With the kids. We didn't kill them and eat them. No. Why would you say that?
All the kids were going to be eating. Chastain, we're not supposed to be mentioning the eating part. Oh, mine's bad.
I thought that we were going to eat them. That's why we took them from the demons. Wasn't that it?
Nein, we did it to take care of them, remember?
What did they find out about the master plan? Sorry, it's like 15-year-old joke now.
Hans and Franz, you know, there's no way. Nick, if we bring up all these old Saturday Night Live jokes, the kids
it's
today
Saturday
are going to get
Saturday Night Live, that's Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Well, they're sort of a joke off of, I think, the Hans and Franz thing, too.
Well, one of them is German, but the other one's not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that one was just normal.
I guess a little bit, though, because wacky German accents are wacky, I guess. But anyhow.
I was going to use this for a Making Copies reference, but I guess that's just gone now.
So, Ray says, I can't read the text.
Oh. Sound went out, too, there. It was ominous. It was like a scene out of a horror movie. Nick gets real close to the screen, and you see him talking, no words coming out, and just like a skeletal hand grabs him from the side and pulls him into the underrealm or something like that. I think his sound may have been lost completely there. So we might have to...
No, I'm fine.
Oh, you're good. All right.
I fixed it.
Nick's a genius. You're good.
Okay. So, Ray is still suspicious, super suspicious, because, Ray says, hey, the guy who saved me in the hood, is he with you? It's like, oh yeah, Sanju, he's over here. And Emma's like, so it's not Mr. Minerva. And the girl's like, what? Minerva?
You don't know William Minerva?
And Ray's like, oh my god, stop giving away shit, Emma!
You fool!
But he also brings up, well, that would also mean that besides him, maybe there are other societies and groups of humans on this world. You know, there's so much I want to know about all of this, about the humans who aren't raised as food. But we were able to meet them. We found humans on the outside. And he's like, and so he actually seems to be, like, looking like, oh, yeah, this is great. Yeah, we got saved by humans, and we're going to make it. We're going to find out stuff. We're going to go save our friends. He's gets and he starts to say something, and all of a sudden he realizes something. We don't really learn what he's realized yet. But he looks down, and then, he seems to, I think he's handling the lantern differently. And so he says, hey, you know, thank you for saving us, or else we would have been doomed, so thanks from the bottom of my heart. But there's one thing I want to ask. Why did you save us? Why did demons save us humans, your food? And the girl hesitates, and he's like, yeah, you know, your guys are demons, that you and that man, so what are you up to? Tell us why, demons. And Sanju, the other one, has come up behind them from out of the shadows, carrying his spear menacingly. So, interesting. I guess, just a rogue faction of demons. Hey, maybe they're just, like, fucking bandits or something like that. That's all that happened.
It could be the Brotherhood Without Banners, to make a Game of Thrones reference in there. I do like this conclusion, though, because I've been kind of, like, a little bit in and out of my interest for The Promised Neverland recently, and this is, I guess, the good twist to kind of get me back in. It's kind of assumed that I feel that we're getting the notion of, like, a rogue faction, but it makes sense because the strength of the series was this mental game that was played, and for that to work in the outside world, we need to know the elements that are there, and a rogue faction of the demons is pretty big. I feel like we're going to learn a lot about the demons now pretty quickly, since we've only kind of known them as what we would consider demons, just, like, objectively evil kid-eating monsters, but there must be some other thing to them at this point. So I am very curious to see what happens here. Also, I don't think we've seen a demon that seems human at all. So maybe this is something different as well.
I mean, it was established in Crones that there were some that were much closer to humans than others, but they are very humanoid. And I wonder if it has to do with the way that they're dressed that tipped Ray off, because when the girl took their hands, you could see that her cloak actually covered her hands. You never actually saw them. So I wonder if that had something to do with it.
Very likely.
But, yeah, and interesting. And, yeah, I'm with you, like, that I was happy that we got this chapter because it's like, okay, you know, finally a bit more, like, intrigue and mystery out of this as opposed to, you know, weird adventures in the wilderness, which was a change from what we had before this arc started.
All right. So let's move on then to The Seven Deadly Sins, chapter 224, The Life We Live. And if you're wondering why we're discussing 224 and not 223 at any point, Crunchyroll doesn't have 223 for some reason. It's not quite clear why, but there is no 223 on Crunchyroll as of the recording of this, so we have nothing to work off of there. What helps is that there doesn't seem to have been a whole lot that happened in between this and 222. So I initially read this chapter without realizing that there was a missing point in between, because this one explains what we kind of found out just a bit ago, that Elizabeth's kind of role within Melodius's life is something that's been reoccurring. She has been somebody who would appear in his life and then die tragically in his life, and it's happened over 100 times at this point. And this is the explanation of that. And, you know, Melodius starts by mentioning that, you know, he was a demon, and he sided with the goddess, and because of that, you know, and because she was a goddess associated with demons, we were both punished, essentially by the leader of the demons and the leader of the gods in this pretty kind of terrifying two-page spread, because we see the demon who's just this enormous kind of like trigon, like in like demonic entity with like these horns and this blade that just, I don't even know what it would be used. Like, it doesn't even seem practical. It's almost like a blade with like a giant hook at the end, and it's terrifying. And then the other side, we see the Holy Mother, who doesn't even have a face. She just has a glowing like aura of radiance that shoots out from where a face would be, and all the wings. It's just, it's two very imposing figures of different sides. It's a terrifying scene. And they're like, nothing we did was even like nothing worked against them. Nothing did anything, and we lost our lives, or I thought we should have, but I woke up and I found that Elizabeth had healed me. Then later on, I found somebody who looked exactly like her, and there was no mistake.
It was also named Elizabeth.
Yeah, it was really convenient that way. But it was also, she had the same face, she had the same sort of personality, she had the same powers, which is a very key thing. And eventually what happens is, in time, she would start to remember their past relationship, and it was a trigger that was kind of signed by her gaining those symbols in her eyes. Once she got those, she would remember everything of her previous life, and they, you know, Melodius had to explain, like, we're cursed. I don't know why, like, the gods cursed us, and I don't know what's happening here, but we gotta find a way to break it. You know, Elizabeth's like, please, whatever you do, no matter what happens to me, find a way to break it. And he says, okay, I promise to do that no matter what. Then he says, 3 days later, Elizabeth died before my very eyes in a brutal shot. It's not clear exactly what happened, but she's basically lying in a pile of, like, wood, like, spikes with one just pierced all the way through her. It's not clear if it's meant to be an accident or if someone, like, murdered her or what.
Well, judging by the, because we see a cliff above them, and there's, like, a wall with spiked tops, like the way that you would build, like, a wall around a small, for defense around a, like, a village. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like those fell, and one of them fell through her.
Very possible. And it's kind of curious, I guess, the notion is this, like, Final Destination, like, she's destined to die, or if it's just she will be killed or what, essentially.
The god and goddess get more and more bored every time they kill her, so they just, like, end up having her, like, slip on a banana peel, fly through razor wire.
Yeah, it's just like she takes a rake out of the closet, and somehow it ends with her and a wood chipper. She's like, I don't even know how! A beluga whale just crushes her. Like,
one of the things that the ending focused on was actually a red herring.
Ah, turns out you just got crushed by something inconsequential immediately afterwards. Shock! But this is what Melodius has realized, is that it's the curse put on him, is that he will live, he will not age, and Elizabeth will continue coming back to life over and over again, and she will look the same, she will have the same powers, and she will always fall in love with him, and then die in front of him. And it has happened, as he says, I've come to know 107 Elizabeths. And for the 106th, I tended to her in her final hours. And it's actually kind of an emotional thing, because he's like, no matter how many times I put through it, this is the only part I can never get used to, because they think Elizabeth's dying right now.
Yeah.
And that's why Elizabeth made this promise for me to end her suffering. He's Zeref in a way. He's like, I'm trying to find a way to break this curse of immortality, yeah. Essentially.
And it's, I mean, it's a really, really emotional chapter, and a lot of it is, you know, you see, looking around and seeing everyone's, like, the Seven Deadly Sins reactions to this news, like, Bonn and King are in disbelief, Gauther is kind of more passive about it, Merlin is very stoic, Diane is really emotional, and freaking Hawk is just crying all over the place.
He's sobbing.
This is so, well, it's like, it's kind of one of those things that's like, kind of funny, but also really upsetting because he's just so sad.
So, Melodius explains, he's like, if I'm gonna break this curse, I need a power on the equivalent to be, like, the demon lord or the supreme deity, and I know that Zeldris has a power like that he's borrowed from the demon lord. So, I'm looking to get that and to end this eternal cycle of reincarnation. Diane's like, what's going to happen to you when you do that? What's going to happen to you and Elizabeth? And she's like, we're going to die. And that's the end goal of this journey. So we have to, we don't keep being, she doesn't keep being reborn to suffer, essentially. And,
there's something in particular about, he says 107 Elizabeths, and the number 108 is heavily associated with, Buddhism, like, there's like 108, tasks or something like that you have to, pass in order to achieve nirvana and escape the cycle of reincarnation, which is what Elizabeth is caught up in. So,
that is
one of those things that's thrown in with, you know, a series that references a lot of religious stuff. So,
that is actually a nice point to bring into it. That's essentially the chapter. Like, there's just some thing afterwards where they're like, all right, let's dedicate ourselves to accomplishing this goal, but it's a pretty heavy chapter, because it's really dealing, like, I really did get a sense, because we've noted before, Melodius can be kind of an annoying character, like, when he just jumps up and is like, I'm gonna just start molesting you, because it's funny or whatever. But then, like, in this chapter, you're like, yeah, so I've just have to see the woman I love die 106 times thus far, and it seems
really does recontextualize the way that he's treated her this entire time, so.
Yeah, and he keeps seeing her, and sometimes he'll meet her when she's at different points. Like, sometimes he'll see her when she's a kid, or, you know, when she's, like, a grown adult, or different things. It's like, she's, and knowing that she's going to fall in love with him, that, like, their love will just, like, it's a constant, essentially. It's pretty heavy stuff there. I dig a lot of this revelation, and it really does paint Melodius in a different light that I appreciate. We're really starting to get, like, that whole, sin theme that kind of comes into it, and seeing just what that really entails. It's a series of, like, really tragic love, essentially.
Well, yeah, you've got that going on. You've got the stuff with Bonn and Elaine. Thank God, like, Diane and King are on the same page now. Like, if one of them gets their marriage erased again, I might just be like, no! Someone must be happy.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's even like a side thing too with Berlin and Escobar or Escanor.
Escanor has his unrequited love, and Gowther had his love die tragically, and so yeah.
Yeah, really good chapter.
Good stuff. Let's go on to finish up with One Piece because we have no Black Clover this week. Yeah. It's chapter 870, Parting. Get a little cover page of Bartolomeo kicking some ass. Good for him.
I'm curious if these are supposed to be, maybe I forgot from last time. I feel like they're, from one way you could look at it, like, those aren't bad guys. He just went into this town and took it over. I'm sure they're supposed to be bad guys. He's supposed to be like a hero now, or as much of a hero as the Straw Hats are. But like, I do remember that wasn't he like initially described as being like a really brutal savage monster who caused a lot of chaos across the seas.
Yeah. So we pick up where we left off a couple of weeks ago, with Big Mom hammering on Beige's stone fortress, which is hurting him because it's actually his body. We get a brief little bit of Chiffon who kind of pops a window open, which is kind of a funny little thing. And she's like, look, Mama, it's me. Please don't hurt my husband. We've got a baby. Let us go. And Big Mom's like, you look like Lola! That doesn't really work. She also says something very strange, which is, are you in on this assassination plot? You won't be getting any snacks tomorrow, that's for sure.
Very simplistic way of viewing things, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Obviously all the Big Mom pirates are just kind of, you know, waiting outside, really pissed off, wanting to get at, the alliance that Beige and, Luffy have formed. So Luffy's like, hey, let's go and beat her up. And Nami's like, no! Chopper, grab him!
Luffy, look, I know every other time that this situation has come up, your ultimate conclusion is to go out and fight no matter the odds, but you have to understand this is a fight we can't win. This is one of the four emperors. She's way too tough. We don't have half the crew. That's part of the reason why we came in this group, was so that we could avoid a conflict. If we want to fight them, we're going to have to wait till we have Zolo and the rest of the other, like everyone else. We got what we came for. We just have to go, Luffy, this is the one time that we can't start a fight. We can't go into it. We just have to retreat. Luffy's like, all right. Now fuck that. I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah, that's fuck that noise. I'm jumping out.
It's basically everyone telling him, like, Chopper is holding him back. Nami's trying is like, no, stop it. Stop being reckless. We were here to get Sanji back, and we even got Sanji's family rescued. We're done here. And Brooke's even like, we even got the Poneglyph copies. You know, we are done. Like, let's get out of here. We've got stuff to do. And meanwhile, yeah, the situation with Beige is getting even worse. But Beige has a bit of a badass moment because, you know, he feels sorry for himself for a bit. He's like, oh my god, it sucks that all my plans are in ruin and you guys are all successful. He's like, all right, look, I don't care what happens to you people, but I do care about my men and the wife and the son that I love, and I ain't about to let them die. So there's only one way to ensure that everyone survives. The chamber is inside of my body. Whether I get knocked around or go tumbling, it doesn't affect this space. The same thing if I revert from the big father back to being human. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to return to being human with you all still inside, and then Caesar Clown will pick me up and fly me to safety. And Caesar Clown's like, what? No!
I like this for a couple of reasons. One, I do like this, like, new explanation for the way his power works, that it's not like a side. Like, we knew that he could shrink and people would be, like, tiny inside of him, but it almost seems to be this pocket dimension sort of thing that just, like, kind of exists independent. That's sort of fun. But I also just like that they build Capone to have this level of honor to him, which is nice. There's sort of a unique way of kind of characterizing this supernovas that we've seen thus far. We've already kind of seen that Law is basically an ally. We've kind of gotten enough of an impression of Jewelry Bonnery to suggest she also is a good person at heart. There's sort of a difference that I think is kind of being built up in, like, the supernovas as being, like, a heroic cast, and only the emperors themselves, maybe San Shanks, are, like, the only truly, like, evil forces we've seen out there. I mean, there is still Kid, who's kind of a really big dickhead, And maybe we don't know everything about, like, Hawkins and the music guy whose name I'm blanking on at the moment. But I do just like that they are kind of, like, as they develop the supernovas, they are feeling like characters who live up to that kind of expectation of being introduced to this new group with, you know, variants in their personality and not just being generic, I'm a bad guy with a cool power sort of thing.
Right. So, while Caesar Clown starts to raise objections to this plan of Beige's, because he's like, hey, a lot of them have armament hockey. My gas power won't protect me. We're gonna get killed if we do this. Fuck this. Judge suddenly starts talking to Sanji. He just says, why'd you save us? You know, we fell into the enemy's trap. You didn't need to save us. And Sanji says, because my father would be sad. If I were still fixated on the childhood hatred for my past, then he would be astonished that I turned into such a small man that I would laugh off the death of my own family. And I'll be damned if I lead a life where I can't stand tall and look him proudly in the eye.
His dad's like, Judge is like, oh, my boy. He's like,
no, not no. You. If you haven't, dad.
If you haven't gotten it yet, you're not my dad. Not the person I'm referring to when I'm speaking about my dad. He's like, oh, son. I mean, it's a little late for Father's Day, but come on. Give me a hug. He's like, just no. Kiss
the face.
It's not you. I don't know how to state this.
Just horribly misjudging Judge.
Straightening his tie, dusting like dirt off his shoulders, like expecting some big award to come his way.
Soon they'll send me Father's Day cards, and then he forgets that Sanji hates him, his three sons don't have emotions, and Reiju's just kind of like, meh. Well, surely my loving wife will... Oh, right.
Maybe that dog I got will send me something. Oh, a big dump on the carpet. It's shaped like a heart. Well, I had to kind of move it a little bit to make it look like a heart, so there you go. There. Oh, gift for my dog.
This is a really cool moment for Sanji, you know, showing that, you know, he still remembers, of course, the stuff that he was put through by his father, you know, when he was crying out for him as a child with the iron mask on and stuff. But he's like, hey, I wasn't raised to be the kind of man who would, you know, hold a grudge and do something awful in response to that, though. So this was for me. It wasn't for you. And then he really tears into Judge and he says, you know, hey, Vince McSanji died at sea 13 years ago. That's what you wanted. So admit it. And he freaking drags him down to his knees by his collar and says, you're not my father, Vince McJudge. So don't ever show your face around me again. Damn.
He's pretty harsh on him.
I mean, it's a great reversal of their parting of ways, the 13 years before, you know, it's like, hey, you never show your face before me again. And now Sanji's just like, hey, you never did anything for me. I never want to see your face again after this. So, and, Judge is like, all right, I understand. And I'll never even approach the East Blue again. So, he's going to stay out of Zeff's business and he's going to stay away from Sanji. So there you go. Caesar Clown is still really whining about all of this, but, Judge steps up and he says, hey, until Caesar Clown takes you to safety through the air, then the Germa will serve to guard you. Baby's like, all right, yeah, cause you guys can fly too, so, okay then. Luffy's like, all right, if you guys are gonna fight, then I'm gonna help. And Sanji's like, no, Luffy. And Judge says, I do not need help from a failure. Sanji says, yeah, this is their means of making amends. Caesar Clown's like, I'm still gonna do this! But Beige has his heart still, so yes, he is. Caesar Clown and the Germa and Beige all pop out of the fortress. Beige reverts back from the fortress form. And, the Bimam Clowns all move in immediately to attack. There's a really weird kind of shot because it's, you know, a drawn back shot of the side of the battle as everyone's kind of crashing in. And Big Mom seems kind of like really happy. He's like, yay!
I mean, what we've kind of discovered about her since then, it sort of makes sense, I guess. She does have a weird way of viewing things.
So she moves in to attack. Reiju starts to get beat up on right away. because Big Mom attacks Beige and Seizure Clown, and she has to intercept it. Neji is like, oh, Reiju! And Ichiji's like, it's her fault for being weak. Fulfill the mission. Well, they are assholes without emotions, I guess. Big Mom goes in after Reiju again. She's like, I'm gonna get you! But Sanji and Luffy come flying in with their, you know, elephant gun strike and the Diable Hambe.
Just call him Devil Shot, Nick.
Devil Shot Cross. And Luffy's like, hey, you said we shouldn't fight! And Sanji's like, well, yeah, I said you shouldn't fight. I'm doing it. And freaking the last shot of the chapter is Nami and Chopper and Brooke all being like, no!
Why? Why? Just so many reasons as to why you shouldn't do this.
So, God. I don't think that there was actually a single, like, bad chapter this week and all the stuff that we covered. Aside from the one we never learn chapter, mm-hmm. but then we had the one good one, too.
No, Cross the Council isn't very good either.
Well, but in comparison to the rest of it.
After reading it again, it was actually worse than I thought it was.
It wasn't... I mean, yes, but it's still better.
After I started to look more into that one thing of, like, where are eyes at, I was like, okay, it's actually pretty weird now.
All right, fine.
I like this chapter One Piece a lot. It's very cool. I do love Sanji getting to kind of have his big conclusion. I feel bad because I feel like in any other week, this would probably be, like, character and MVP for me.
But Fat Gum
killed it. Like, Fat Gum just murdered it right out of the gate of just, like, blowing me away. So, I think it hurts a little bit that Luffy came out the same time to have his, like, I'm gonna be a hero too moment. But, it all works. I'm looking
forward to it. Yeah, he could have very well done pretty much the same thing with, Sanji popping out and stopping it, and then Luffy being like, hey, you said we shouldn't find these immediately right behind Sanji.
Or, like, the next chapter starts with Luffy popping out right after him or something like that.
But just very minor differences could have allowed that to happen, you're right. That's gonna do it. You already said what your favorites were, so I guess I'll go over mine. My favorite series of the week is Seven Deadly Sins. That was a very emotional chapter. Really liked, a lot of the stuff that you mentioned, like, the just appearances of the two gods. I really love the way that the, you know, heavenly one looks more like just a painting than an actual thing that could physically exist. Just the sheer emotion of it. I like the explanation that's given. It's a really big game changer, and I think it's really good. My character's gonna go with Sanji, because I thought this was a really big moment for him. And I just really like some of the stuff that he hits on, talking about, you know, how he just flat out thinks of Zeff as his father, and you really see that in the way that he talks to his blood father about it. And, you know, the kind of resentful savior attitude about him, I guess you could call it. So that's that. We are done for this edition of Weekly Manga Recap. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We do this show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. approximately on hitbox.tv/RoloT and twitch.tv/RoloT. Not hitbox.tv anymore. Smashcast.tv/RoloT. My bad. For stuff that changes, like we have to record the show at a different time or use a different platform, heaven forbid. You can follow us on Twitter at RoloT and at YRollerOfTime, as well as the official podcast account, which is at WMRPodcast. You can also check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, youtube.com/weeklymangarecap, and on iTunes. And if you do all that stuff, be sure to give us a subscription, leave a comment and rating so that you can help us beat the woodworkers in the hobby section.
Yes, I've missed this one. I haven't brought up iTunes in a couple weeks, so I want to give a special thanks to BassForever24601, who says, hashtag Team Ray. The only people who could act like this are plebs who don't have their baby memories. I'm going to set myself on fire and then listen to another wrestling reference. It's a 5-star review, though, so I thank you for it.
If you want to send us feedback, ask us questions for our Q&A episodes, or suggest future manga for us to read, you can send all that stuff to our email account, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com, so we can go over that stuff, keep track of it, and get back to you on it.
Well, Special thanks. Our Q&A is actually going to be coming up probably pretty soon. We're in July now, so it'll be a new one that will come out.
Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy.
Special thanks, by the way, go to OVO Hoot. I don't know if that's supposed to be a face, but I'm going to pronounce it as though it's a name. A Fox Behind the Wheel, and Nicholas Gaffney. Thank you very much, guys, for supporting the show. It is much appreciated. A fist bump for you being cool people.
And finally, special thanks go out to Steve Mann, our aforementioned tile cars. You can check out his work in a bunch of different places, including his own Patreon, patreon.com/Steve Mann, where you can see pretty much all of the tile cards that he's done for us, as well as his own artwork. If you become a supporter of his, then you can see his NSFW stuff. And also thanks to Infamous Flange who created the frame for the video editions of the podcast and stuff like that. Thank you guys so much, and we will be back. I think that it'll probably be about 2 weeks or so before we do Wraith Master, because...
It'll be a bit. Yeah. It's a busy time for, I think, both of us.
And it's a pretty long series, too, so...
Yeah. I'm very...
We'll have it in time for, we'll have it before Fairy Tale's over, I think, but...
That's the dream, right?
We're up.
We should dream big like that. All right, guys, we need something wacky to go out on, so...
You can just do the Raid Master theme song.
Oh, yeah.
With a Peridot's dog!
I call up Real Big Fish. I'm like, hey, do you guys want to be at the podcast to discuss this theme song? They're like...
Sure, well, we got nothing better to do.
They're like, oh, we'd love to. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, we did an entire full-length song. They said do, like, a minute and a half worth. We did a full 4 minutes. It's on an EP. Like, it's a song we did. We were,
Long glory!
Yeah, you're like... Look, you may have heard, like, the first chorus of Revolution, but you didn't hear it. Like, it gets so much better later on. That's when we start adding some Caribbean influences to it to kind of, you know, really, you know, get into the whole musical diversity that plays a part in Rave Master's influences. It's just like 3 days later, it's just that someone being like...
We're just like Megashima this week? Nah.
That's just something like, hey, you've been in a Skype call for 4 straight days. It doesn't look like the other person's on the other end. They're like, no, of course they're still listening. I've had a lot to tell them about Revolution.
No one would hang up on us if you were a Real Big Fish.
Like, we're the Real Big Fish. Of course they're listening still. As though they're not bigger than us.
Random shit.
Yeah, they're like, we're so much bigger than you.
They're our new rivals, along with the woodworkers.
We just keep picking fights with people bigger than us. I'm just like, this Brad Pitt guy, oh my god. It's like, hey guys, I did like a couple big movies and then a bunch of shit every so often. Oh, well, I'm such a wanker. I'm going to sleep in this pile of money. All right, bye, everybody.